On Health Policy and Public Affairs to order on this day of January 24th. I would like to also turn it over to Representative Greenlick to open up his committee, and then I'll be running the show today.
He runs the show all the time.
I open the House Committee on Health Care and a hearing on House Bill 2201. I just want to make a brief statement to my colleagues on the committee. I really want to make sure as we work this bill that we have plenty of time to ask and get answers to the questions that are on your mind. We had a testimony on Monday that was pretty much not ceremonial, but pretty much testify. Make sure today you have your chance to ask the questions you want of the witnesses. And if we need to get other witnesses, we're working on Friday's schedule, Friday from 3 to 5, and we'll make sure there are folks that can answer the questions that you need answered.
Great.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
All right. I'd like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 31. Just for the audience, Senate Bill 31 is the Senate version, which is basically the same version as House Bill 2201. All right. For the record, first, I would like to make sure that, first of all cell phones please turn off, and please respect those who are at the dais. I do want to enter into the record the National Association of Social Workers was not able to be here, and they have, I think, testimony that was given to all of you. It's in front of you for House Bill 2201 and Senate Bill 31. They enthusiastically support the Oregon Healthy Kids program. With that, I would like to start out with Linda Solaris. No. Actually, we're going to start out with Aaron Kelly Seal. That's not on my... Yeah, we'll do invited testimony first. Thank you so much. And with that, Aaron Kelly Seal and Ree Sailors and Lori Freeman somewhere. Okay.
Good morning, Madam Chair, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Aaron Kelly Seal, and with me is Ree Sailors. We together advise the governor on health and human service related issues. Ree may not have yet had the opportunity to meet each of you. She joined our staff about a month ago, and we are going to be dividing our policy issues. But for now, because I have been with the office working on Healthy Kids for so long, she has graciously allowed me to share this issue with her. But we will be jointly responding to questions today, and I'm going to take the lead on the slide presentation that walks through some of the programmatic elements of the proposal before you in House Bill 2201 and in Senate Bill 31. We appreciate the opportunity to be here. You heard on Monday, forgive me as I'm learning about the computer, you heard on Monday a lot about the problem in our state with respect to kids without insurance. The most recent data that we have from our Office of Health Policy and Research coming out of a study they did in 2004 gives us a total number of about 117,000 kids between the ages of 0 and 18 who do not have insurance. About half of those kids, about 60,000 of them, qualify for our existing programs. We have basically, the Oregon Health Plan and the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program are available to these families today, but they're not currently enrolled. And I think it's important to make the point that even kids with insurance don't always have access to basic health care that meets the needs they have, like medicine, eyeglasses, basic health services. There was a report that just actually was published yesterday by Children First for Oregon, and if you haven't had a chance yet to take a look at it, it's on their website, and it looks like this. It described, in particular, the kinds of health disparities, health inequities, if you will, that kids of low-income families, kids of color, kids in rural communities are facing, and some of those kids that face those challenges are even kids with insurance. This book, by the way, that I just held up will tell you county by county specific information relative to your district. So I think it's something that you may want to take a look at if you have a chance to. Speaking of where the kids are, this map is designed to just give you a picture of where the geographic distribution of Oregon's uninsured kids. And what we didn't put on this map, which I was realizing last night that we probably should have, was actually the percentage of uninsured in each of these regions. And so, for example, if you look over to our eastern side of the state, even though there are only 5,928 kids in that area that are uninsured, that represents 26% of the children in that area that do not currently have insurance. And I think, again, just going back to the point about kids in rural communities who really struggle, even with insurance, to have access to health care, those percentages, I think, put an exclamation point behind the numbers that you see on the slide. Another point that I think you heard a lot about on Monday is that many of our uninsured in Oregon, over half, are actually in middle-class working families that earn between $40,000 and $80,000 a year. In fact, in this country, the fastest-growing segment of the uninsured is the middle class. And the reason for that is that they are still struggling to afford what it costs them to live, and we'll talk about that a little bit more, and the health insurance that is either offered to them through their employer or maybe not for their children. There are employers that do the right thing and offer insurance but sometimes aren't able to contribute much to that, which makes it extremely unaffordable for families to cover their kids. And some employers would like to do the right thing but aren't able to offer that coverage for dependents. We have, over the last couple of years, learned a little bit about why there are so many of our uninsured kids who should be in our existing programs but are not. We call them enrollment barriers, and we found out through a survey that the Office of Health Policy and Research did that there were some challenges, like the application is incredibly overwhelming. It's very long. Currently, it's 11 pages. We currently have a policy in place in the state for those programs that requires families to recertify or re-enroll in the program every 6 months. When families would miss that recertification period, they would then be subject to the uninsurance requirement that we currently have, which is a 6-month uninsurance requirement. And so they would be left without coverage for a minimum of 6 months just by missing that window, even though they technically had been enrolled in the program before. We also had some confusion when we experienced the economic downturn several years ago and Measure 30 failed. We lost coverage for many low-income adults through the Oregon Health Plan Standard Program, and we found that parents were confused. If they were not eligible for coverage, they either made the assumption or weren't getting the right information about the fact that their children may still be eligible for the programs, and so we've certainly been working on that issue with our Department of Human Services field offices. Making the case for the importance of insurance, again, I think you heard a lot of personal testimony about this on Monday, but the statistics are that kids without insurance are half as likely to get that front-end preventive care or see a doctor than kids who actually are insured. And what that means is that they show up in our emergency departments with a condition that could have been treated much earlier on for much less expense and much less of a health consequence to the child or their family. And we end up actually paying the cost for that, those of us who are insured. We also know that kids without insurance, because those health conditions tend to worsen rather than get better, they end up more likely to be hospitalized and in the hospital than kids who have insurance and are getting that more front-end preventive care earlier on in the stage of their illness. There's definitely a connection between kids with health insurance, kids who are healthy, and their ability to learn. And I know everybody in this room understands that connection very, very well. We do have some statistics about kids who aren't healthy in school, but the bottom line is that if they can't see the chalkboard, they're not necessarily being able to take advantage of that educational opportunity. And it just sort of spirals from there in terms of having health conditions that sometimes have a lifelong influence on them as adults and their productivity levels. Again, in terms of cost and saving money, we know that uninsurance places the cost of health care out of reach for most families. And so when those uninsured kids who are more likely to be hospitalized are hospitalized, their parents are left struggling to pay the medical bills. And it's, I think, just always fascinating to know that about half of the personal bankruptcies in this country are attributable to medical causes. And so, again, just as a family without insurance, to back up the cost for things like hospitalization, the cost for more chronic conditions that children may have, those costs are being borne by those of us with insurance, actually. That next statistic, over 40% of those hospital costs are passed on in the form of higher costs to us, I think really describes the relationship between insurance and this program and the broader issue that the governor mentioned on Monday. He knows that many of you have spent a lot of time on that he, too, is very concerned about, which is reducing our health care costs in the state and also expanding insurance beyond just all children but to all Oregonians. There has been this project, this particular plan that's before you in the bill, has actually been in the making for quite a while. And the term that was used on Monday was that this is really a collaborative plan. I know those words kind of get thrown around quite a bit, but we actually have documented proof in this case of that collaboration. The Medicaid Advisory Committee began hosting a series of statewide public forums in April of last year, and they actually traveled to Medford, Bend, LeGrand, Newport, Corvallis, and Portland, and invited families, teachers, providers to join them and talk about the policy and programmatic framework for a coverage program for all kids. At the same time, our esteemed chair.
Just for the audience to know, we have an overflow room that is now open in Hearing Room D, if you would like to sit in Hearing Room D. Sorry, Erin.
No problem. At the same time, Chair Mona Sanderson and the Senate were holding public hearings, public discussions about the same issues in the Capitol. Lots of invited testimony that was incredibly valuable in terms of input, and lots of parents and advocates also attending those hearings to provide input. Once we had that basic policy and programmatic framework in place, our office then hosted a series of stakeholder meetings last fall and in the summer to get input around some of the more programmatic detail, implementation, administration. And we had literally hundreds of people attend those meetings. And so we feel like what's in front of you has been well vetted, but certainly policy discussion continues about some really critical pieces of the proposal. Key components of the plan, offer coverage to all uninsured children up to age 19. Sometimes you'll see statistics about uninsured kids that only take you up to 0 to 17. They don't include the 18-year-olds. But this plan actually includes those kids because we can receive federal funding to match our state contribution for kids up through age 18. The proposal is that the benefit package that would be offered through the plan would be comprehensive, that it would include not just physical health, but also dental health and mental health coverage. The idea behind the program is to build on the existing programs, not create new bureaucracy at the state and government levels. We also want to be sure that, and we heard this repeatedly in all of the public discussions about the program, that this really needed to be kept simple for families. And so the proposal is based on an idea that every child in the program would have one card. So when you see in a moment the different components of the program and the different funding streams that support it, that would be really invisible to families. Families would just know that their child was covered and had a card when they needed to when they needed it to go see a physician or a dentist. And we also had gotten some very good feedback about simplifying enrollment.
Representative Greenlick. I'd like a question.
That card would be the same for either of the parts of the program.
That's right.
Thank you.
The basic framework for the program is really to meet children's health care needs in three ways. The first is to expand opportunities for families, those working families that I talked about, who today don't have other options, to meet them halfway and put health care within their reach. And so the proposal is to actually structure affordable coverage for those families, and I know we're going to have some good discussion about what it means for that coverage to be affordable. But today we don't offer anything to those families, and when we went around the state and we were talking both with families, all of whom were working, whether they were at the lower income levels or the middle income levels, just unanimously the cry was, we need some help. We want to be sure that we're not, as we do that expansion, that we're not ignoring the fact that there are so many children who should be in our current programs and are not, and so we want to take some steps in the plan to simplify the enrollment process and keep kids enrolled. And lastly, I think a point that will be made more as you go through this process, but there's a definite connection between actually having insurance and being able to access a physician or a healthcare provider, but it also works the other way. It's not necessarily the case that if you have insurance that you can access a physician or a provider. And so there's some elements of what the governor's proposing that you consider that actually are designed to address the access issue and give families opportunities through schools, for example, to have health care more available to them than if they had to take time off work and go to a physician's office.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Thank you,
Gardley.
Thank you very much, and good morning.
Good morning.
Good to see you all. This may be the best place to ask a question about the Children's System Change Initiative, which is focused on children's mental health. And you can help me gain a better understanding of what the connection is between that initiative and this Healthy Kids initiative. And I ask the question, remembering that back in November, the Human Services Subcommittee of the Emergency Board heard a report. It was an evaluation of the Children's System Change Initiative. And what we heard is that in order to continue making significant progress in children's mental health system reform, that we need resources invested, more training, technical assistance, support for the continuing development of local systems of care and coordination. The evaluation was conducted by Portland State University. What we also learned at that emergency board meeting, and since then, is that the resources that would support the Children's System Change Initiative were not contained in the budget, the Department of Human Services budget presented to the governor. So I'm just looking for some clarification of where's the connection. What about the resources to carry forward with that initiative? And again, that was an initiative that we created or passed in the last legislative session.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, I'm really glad that you raised this issue because I think it's important, again, if we're looking at really meeting kids' health care needs, that we expressly acknowledge that there are a lot of kids in the state that have mental health care needs that aren't being met. And today, unfortunately, because of the recession, the state plays a role in meeting mental health care needs for kids only if they're eligible for the Oregon Health Plan. And what the legislature started in 2003 and then continued in 2005, the initiative that Senator Gordley is referencing was called the Children's Mental Health System Change Initiative. It's kind of a mouthful. It was focused specifically on our Medicaid services for kids, and the idea that has now taken hold statewide is that the payment for those services would be capitated through our mental health organizations, and what that would allow them to do was to better meet kids' mental health needs on the front end of their mental health crisis or of their detection that they may have a mental illness. Unfortunately, as I said, that initiative really focuses on services just for ROHP-eligible kids, so low-income kids and families. And as we've heard in the governor's office, repeatedly for the last several years, there are many, many families who have been struggling to meet their kids' mental health needs who actually have private insurance. The other thing the legislature did in 2005 was pass mental health parity. And that particular policy change, I think, will begin to help families better meet kids' mental health needs that aren't necessarily in our Medicaid system. But there are two outstanding issues which I think the Healthy Kids program really does continue in terms of this progress we're making on this issue. The first is in terms of resources, and although it's true, Senator Gordley, that the governor's budget doesn't specifically allocate a line item for system change, the resources through the Healthy Kids Plan will undoubtedly make a difference in our capacity to serve kids with mental health needs. First of all, about 68,000 of the kids, remember I said over 60,000, we estimate it's about 68,000 of the kids who do not have insurance today will now be eligible for our comprehensive benefit package through the Oregon Health Plan. And so those thousands of kids will actually have more access than they ever have before to the system change initiative that you all began to implement. The other issue, though, isn't just a resource issue. It's really a structural issue. And our office has begun discussions across our state agencies and including the Department of Education about how we need to do a better job serving the family and their need as opposed to just applying our resources based on the funding stream from which we receive them. That conversation is a really tough one, and we're going to ultimately be having it with our federal partners, but it has been started. And what we're being told by those local systems of care is that that conversation at the state level is integral to them being able to continue their work. The most recent good news we had is we got federal approval to use some resources that already were in the system to specifically target this particular project. And so I think with the new resources from Healthy Kids, as well as the structural conversation that's happening across state agencies, we are very well poised to continue the policy direction the legislature has given us on this issue.
Madam Chair, just follow up. Thank you very much for the explanation. It's very thorough, and you've definitely made the connection for me. Thank you very much.
Back to the structure for the plan. We were just talking about those kids that would now be eligible for what we call our Oregon Health Plan Plus benefit package. In Medicaid, certain people are called are categorically eligible. The federal government says these folks must be eligible for our programs. For those folks, we actually receive federal funding. The match rate for categorically eligible kids in Medicaid is 60-40. Beyond that, we also receive a different federal contribution rate, 30 to 70, for the Children's Health Insurance Program, or CHIP, which you may have heard of before. But in Oregon, already we've had some experience with this seamlessness across programs because we have essentially the same program for kids who would technically be on the CHIP program or technically be on Medicaid. For all of those families, they're in the Oregon Health Plan. And they receive a benefit package that includes comprehensive benefits, dental, vision, mental health care, and the package follows the prioritized list of health services, which the legislature enacted over a decade ago in terms of the framework for the Oregon Health Plan. And so while we at the state level understand which children are eligible for which funding stream, that's not something that the families have to understand or know about. And so we call it the Oregon Health Plan Plus package. In that package, because those families are our families with the lowest incomes, they do not have to pay every time they go see the doctor, and they do not have to make a monthly payment for their children to stay enrolled in the program. Oops, I went backward instead of forward. We also, for low-income families, but also are proposing that for families now up through 200% of the federal poverty level. I should say, by the way, that today in Oregon, we only cover children and families up to 185% of the federal poverty level. So that slide I just showed you does represent an expansion up to 200% for those families that would not. I mean, the big difference for those families is both the benefit package, which I highlighted, as well as the fact that they do not have to pay every time they need to see every time they need to go see a health provider.
Madam Chair?
Yes. Representative Flores?
Thank you, Ms. Seeley. Could you just give us the dollar figure that would be the equivalent of both federal poverty level?
Sure.
Figures?
I have my little sheet here. For this depends. This is yearly income that I will give you, and I'll give you for a family of two as well as for a family of four, if I could.
Mm-hmm.
Just for some perspective, for a family of two to be living at the federal poverty level, so that's at 100% according to the federal formula from 2006, it's $13,200 a year, and that's gross. That's before taxes or anything else. That same family of two at 185% of the federal poverty is making $24,420 a year, and at 200% of the federal poverty level is making $26,400 a year. Would it be helpful to hear family of four as well?
Sure.
Okay. Family of four, at the federal poverty level, 100% of the federal poverty level, a family of four has an income of $20,000 a year. At 185% of the federal poverty level, that income is $37,000 a year. And at 200% of the federal poverty level, for a family of four, the income is their annual income is $40,000 a year.
Yes. Representative Maurer.
Yes. Madam Chair, just to let you know that the 2007 federal poverty level was published yesterday, and so those figures need to be revised.
Thank you.
We will do that. We were studying for today's hearing. We missed the announcement.
Studying for the test.
That's right. The Family Health Insurance Assistance Program is a program that offers a private insurance product to families, and it looks a lot different than the Oregon Health Plan product. Most private insurance products are not as comprehensive, and they also have cost sharing associated with them, which means that you would pay every time you went to see the physician, or you would pay a premium, or you may actually pay a percentage of the cost of your visit called coinsurance. In the Family Health Assistance Program today, we serve, we support employers who have individuals working for them who are eligible for the subsidy. And so today, that includes anyone up to 185% of the federal poverty level. But that employer, if they offer coverage through the subsidized program, must also offer coverage to all of their employees, and they won't get the subsidy for employees who are at the higher income levels. We also offer individual subsidized coverage to people whose employers may not offer it to them, but who on their own want to buy insurance. And so we do subsidize families through FEOP individually. The proposal through Healthy Kids is to continue for families who have group coverage through their employer to continue so that they can still be on the same plan as a family to use the FEOP program for their child. But the subsidy of that, but we would remove the cost sharing for the child in that particular family coverage option. For kids, and so again, that's really up to 200% of the federal poverty level, and then and it really, the specific piece of this applies to the group coverage, not to individual coverage. For kids who would just be their families,
Aaron,
would just be signing up.
I think it's important to clarify that again. For those families that have employer-based insurance and they meet the federal poverty level, they will still keep their own insurance plan, but there's no... Just explain that piece again.
If their employer chooses to participate in the FEOP program, that family would have the option of keeping their child in the group coverage FEOP subsidized plan that their employer is offering them. They would also have the option to participate in what we're about to describe as the private insurance product. Their child could have a different insurance product than they do if that family chose to.
And there'd be a subsidy?
Would there be a subsidy?
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, yes. There would be a subsidy on the FEOP side. We would anticipate that families up to 200% of the federal poverty level for their kids would not pay premiums, but they would still have the cost sharing associated with that plan.
Yes. Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for an excellent and very informative presentation. For the kids that are on FEOP up to 200%, would they would not automatically move over to the OHP Plus under the new system?
That would be a choice up to the family. Excuse me, Representative Gelser, Chairman.
And for the record, introduce yourself.
I'm sorry. I'm Reese Ehlers from the Governor's Office. It would be a family choice. So the parents would make that decision whether they could stay with the employer insurance through the FEOP program or have the opportunity to come into the state option.
I might have, Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, I might have Rocky King, the administrator of the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program, describe this dynamic a bit, because I have to be reminded of it myself every now and again. I think our proposal, and some of this is malleable, is different for kids who are currently on the program, and so to continue kind of continuity of coverage and care for them versus kids who would newly be enrolling. So I'd like to have Rocky King speak to that if we could. Is that okay?
Yes.
Just a reminder, Rocky Wu is slated to present to the committee on Friday for a fuller presentation.
Oh. I am. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Rocky King. I'm the administrator for the Office of Private Health Partnerships, which administers the FEOP program and is involved in the private sector component of the Healthy Kids Plan. Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, Representative Gelser, for kids that are under 200% of poverty in FEOP, if they're currently in FEOP without Healthy Kids, if there's group coverage available to them, they must accept that group coverage. And they don't have the choice of an individual plan in the private sector market. Healthy Kids is going to change that dynamic to some degree. First of all, if they have group coverage available and they're under 200% of the poverty, they would have a choice. The parent would actually make a decision. Do I want to have the child remain in the group coverage, whether that's ODS, Blue Cross, Kaiser, whatever that may be, or do I want to have that child enrolled in Healthy Kids? Generally, it'll be to the advantage of the parent to enroll them in Healthy Kids, especially if it's a small business group plan, because the benefit structure is going to be a lot better. There's not going to be copays and deductibles. And we will have choice counselors as a part of our administration that will kind of assist folks and point out the pros and cons of you know, which direction to go. It is anticipated that every child that's enrolled in FEOP now, below 200%, will be given the option to either stay where they are or to grandfather in. After, and that's both the group and individual market, after Healthy Kids is initiated, the individual market for kids below 200% will no longer be an option. Group could be an option or Healthy Kids, but we're not going to just allow children to stay in the individual market.
And the reason for that, is my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, is we need to be taking advantage of matching dollars. And if they're in FEOP, are we able to still take advantage of the matching dollars?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that is correct,
yeah.
Both for FEOP and for Healthy Kids. But you're trying to balance giving parents options, but at the same time giving them the information so they take the best option for the kids. And the Healthy Kids and the comprehensive benefit plan that we've put, I think, in place is going to be a very, very strong incentive to move over to the Healthy Kids side.
Thank you. That was very helpful, especially understanding about the choice counselors that will help families take advantage of this very well prepared plan. Thank you.
Okay. Yes, Representative Richardson.
Madam Chair, while Mr. King is at the table, it might be helpful to have the two of you address this issue of, we're talking about 117,000 uninsured children, but what you have just said and what we're understanding is that doesn't include the number of children whose families, being able to do basic arithmetic, will say, if I take my kids off my coverage and self-insure for 60 days. After 60 days, have them come onto the program. They're going to have full medical, dental, and optical, and I won't have to pay the premium portion for the kids. And so does the fiscal and does, you know, have you anticipated that there will be a large number of families who will be able to say, maybe I should have my kids be involved in this too, since it's a wonderful program?
If I may, Representative Richardson, Chair Mona San Edgerson, and Chair Greenlick, I'm having a tough time with the
green break.
If I might try and answer that, speaks to the issue that's frequently called crowd out. It's been around, the topic has been around for almost a decade now, and a number of data have informed the way we put this together and the way we've budgeted for it, too. One thing, every state in the nation who has an SCHIP program is required to look at their crowd out rates and to report them. And so we've looked at the data, and basically what you see across the states is the crowd out rate, which is that that movement from a private non-public mechanism into a public mechanism. The crowd out rate generally runs between 1 and at a top of 5%. What we saw, interestingly enough, in the state of New York, who had no, and there are different ways to control whether or not that movement happens. One of the ways to control it is to have what's called a period of uninsurance requirement. And in Healthy Kids, there is a 60-day period of uninsurance requirement. Some states have more than that. In fact, as I looked at the data last night, if you look across the states, it's about a third, a third, a third, in terms of states and the length of time of their period of uninsurance. New York is unique in the sense that it has no period of uninsurance, and even there they had a fairly, again, under a 5% movement between the private to the public product. So with that 1 to 5% in our own experience is we put in a 3% factor for that kind of crowd out phenomena to occur. The other thing that compounds with this question is the whole erosion of employer-sponsored coverage, and particularly around dependent coverage. That is probably more serious, a fueler, if you wish, to moving people from private coverage into public programs, because we're seeing a significant erosion of employer-sponsored coverage, and always there has been, and increasingly there is, a lack of contribution towards the family dependent coverage. Frequently you'll see businesses who will cover the employee but not contribute towards the cost of the dependents. Here in Oregon, the offer rate among our employers, and this is all sizes of employers, and it gets worse as you go down in the size of the employer, our offer rate dropped from 1996 from 61.5% to 52.7% as of 2004, which was the latest data. We will have some new data coming out soon. Our population survey is, the numbers are being scrubbed, and probably in another month we'll have those figures, if not sooner. So what you see there, and then compounding that, is as you have seen the stagnation in wages over the last number of years, what you also see is the employee's ability to take up the offer of insurance is also declining. So consequently, what you see is even in firms where dependent coverage is offered, the ability of the employee to take that coverage up because of affordability issues is reduced, is also falling, and is now at about a 35% level. So even when offered, only about 35% of the employees can actually afford to take up the offer that the employer provides to them. So that's kind of a...
That was a very broad answer to a fairly specific question. My understanding that you're saying that you factor in that 3 families out of 100 who currently have their kids insured are likely to say, I'm not going to pay that money anymore, and I'll get dental and optical and everything by letting my kids go into this program. You only think 3 out of 100 will do that?
Yes, although their cost sharing will vary according to their income. If they're below 200%, they wouldn't have cost sharing in the public program. However, if they're above 200%, there will be cost sharing for those families. So it's not a free program if they decide to do that.
Thank you.
I'm just learning the names. You got to turn
Bruin.
Yes, Representative Bruin. My eyesight.
Thank you very much. I want to follow up on that just a little bit. You talk about the erosion within the over the last 10 years or however long we've monitored within the employer-based coverage of dependents. With all your models that you've used to put this together, have you talked about the erosion that could potentially, I don't know that it will for sure, but the erosion that will potentially happen with employers who right now do offer some sort of dependent care, whether it's the employee has to pick up the full share or whether the employer does. Is there going to be an incentive or a disincentive, however you want to look at it, for employers in the state of Oregon? Well, the state's got it covered, so even though we were offering this, we don't need to. We'll stay whole with our employees, but still turn off our ability to, or our desire, if you will, to insure their kids.
Well, and as Rocky was saying a moment ago, if employer-sponsored insurance is available, we ask the families to take advantage of that, and then we help them afford that. So in that situation, you get what's sometimes called a three-share program, where you have the employer contributing, the family contributing, and the state coming in to make it so the family can meet the employer, essentially.
Follow up. And one follow up. Thank you very much. And this crowd out factor that you mentioned, first time I'd heard that term, but I think it's an interesting term. Another factor, I wonder if you have addressed it or have modeled it at all, would be the move in factor. If we have this very nice system, I mean, it's middle class healthcare, let's call it what it is, do we become a national or even an international magnet for families with kids to come to Oregon? And how do we, if that's true, if we can assume there is some sort of incentive, how do we model that? How do we project that for future budget years?
Well, I think that cuts two ways. First of all, I think people move because of jobs, not because of health insurance. I think really it's not enough to say I can get health insurance over there. It's like, how am I going to get housing, food, clothing, and support my family? So I don't believe that health insurance is the primary stimulant for people to change their residence. It is whether or not they can get employment. The other side of it, and I'm not trying to be glib in any way, but, you know, as we attempt to attract business and industry into the state, one of the factors that they consider as they approach a state is what is the capacity and performance of their education system and their healthcare systems and the availability of coverage for the families of the workers they would bring or have in that state. So I think we really don't see that. There have been other states who have had very generous healthcare programs for long periods of time. One of the ones that comes to mind is Minnesota is quite known to have excellent healthcare benefits, but we have never seen any kind of flocking to those kinds of benefits.
Thank you.
And Representative Greenlick.
Thank you. I'd just like to follow up briefly Representative Richardson's question on crowd out. Right now, if a family is under 185%, they have the option to move into CHIP, don't they?
For the children. Representative, for the children?
Yes.
Yeah, that is correct.
So the only difference now is between 185 and 200%.
That's right.
It's in that small segment of the population that currently doesn't have the option to move into CHIP. It would.
Representative, are you talking about expanding healthy kids up to 200%?
Yeah.
Those children will have the option of CHIP.
What will be new is the group between 185 and 200%.
That is correct.
See, right, I think the point is right now there are children that are covered under some probably health plans up to 185% poverty level, and they are not giving up that insurance to come into the Oregon health plan.
Madam Chair, that is correct. We have approximately 3,000 to 4,000, maybe more than that. It's about 5,000, I think, people enrolled in group coverage, of which about 40% are children. Those parents have the option of moving those children currently to the state's CHIP program, but have chosen for a variety of reasons, which relate to providers, stigma, keeping
the family in the same plan have chosen to have those children remain with their employer group coverage.
Yes, Representative Flores.
Thank you, Chair Monis Anderson. Ms. Saylors, you just indicated that when people are contemplating a move because of workforce placement, what have you, two criteria that they look at are the education system and their public ability to provide insurance. I didn't realize that second component was a significant determining factor.
No, let me clarify, Representative Flores. What I was saying is that as businesses look to locate their factories or their headquarters or whatever into states, part of their whole index of factors that they look at, and it's not exclusive to these, are, you know, how good is their education system in order to give them the workforce they need to produce whatever they're producing, and secondly, how good is their health care system and the coverage availability in that state, because that's part of the worker retention, recruitment retention equation for them.
Quick follow-up, Madam Chair.
Yes, follow-up.
Thank you. And in sync.
No, and it does, I'm sorry. Excuse me.
Go ahead. Maybe you'll answer my question.
Aaron just helped me understand better your question, I think. And it's not that they're looking at the publicly financed healthcare system, but the system in toto and, you know, how many of the people who live in that state are able to access that system.
Any other?
Thank you. I just think I'd like more information on that particular element point.
Sure.
We can do that offline.
Thank you. Representative Maurer.
Thank you. Madam Chair, this is about the crowd out rate and the New York data that you are referring to. I'm assuming that data is not that current. It's a historical data. Is that correct?
I would say that it's relatively current, actually, because these are routine reports that states do on the crowd out factors. So this would not be they have to report this to CMS routinely, and so this would be taken from current data.
Current data, 1 year's?
Yeah, probably a year old. But also the reporting's been going on for how many years now?
New York State was one of the first.
Yeah, I was going to say SCHIP has been in place for quite a long time in New York. So I would say a minimum of 7 to 8 years.
Okay. My question is really from that 200% to 350. If they choose to, as an employee, choose to not cover their children for 60 days and take a deep breath and hope nothing happens because they can get a much better program under this new status. I guess I question that 1 to 5% and then the 3% assumption that as an employer, you know, I'm going to be counseling my employees to say, well, you know, maybe it is a better program.
Let me point out two things. New York is the state, an example, that had no barrier, and so there was no waiting period whatsoever, so they could stop tomorrow and on their stop today on their employer sponsored coverage and go directly to the state's programs without any waiting period. We have put a waiting period into ours in terms of a period of uninsurance, as we call it. The other control that we have, I'll make 3 points. That was the first one. The second one is the other control we have is that we program is we have periodic open enrollment periods, so you don't just come in any day of the week, any month of the year per se, some of these programs. Just like I, as an employee of the state, I have an annual enrollment window, and I come in during that window. We are limiting how many of those windows per year, which inadvertently creates somewhat of a waiting period, and then. Oh, Thank you. I've just given a note here that says also in New York, their programs go up to 275% of poverty. So they're much, it's a much higher income range than what we're talking about. There's absolutely no barrier whatsoever, and it's still a relatively low crowd out rate, essentially. Crowd out, if I can go back for one second, is crowd out's been around since, you know, a lot of academics make a lot of papers about this, and when some of the CHIP programs came forward and when they were initially passed by Congress, there was a great deal of concern about crowd out, and I can't tell you how many papers were written and studies were done and everything, and there was a big hoo-ha about it. The reality is, over time, what we found out, it just really didn't amount to that much, that people were making a lot out of something that they were scared about happening, but in reality, families weren't doing that. And, I can't tell you what the chemistry or the algorithms are that families use to make their decisions. But the reality is, as we've gone through now for years looking at this thing, it stays down there pretty constant. There have been all kinds of different program availabilities to people, to families in a variety of states. And what we see is it's a fairly constant factor. And we've put that into the calculation of the financing and budget for this.
Thank you.
We had this extensive conversation in the Senate also, so they're good questions. I think you really need to have a good handle on it. Thank you. Can we proceed quickly?
I will proceed quickly.
Because we have a lot behind you.
I'm sorry. we started talking.
But I do not want, we need to have these questions answered.
Yes, definitely.
Go ahead.
So we had started talking about the new private insurance product that would be available to families with incomes higher than 200% of the federal poverty level. And the feedback that we received from stakeholders, as well as, which included, I should say, families of children, was that they were really hoping that what we would offer would be comprehensive and include things that to them should already be in their plans, like mental health coverage or dental coverage, but that maybe were not. And an interesting fact, and we'll get to this a little bit later in terms of some of the access pieces, but that oral disease is actually the most prevalent chronic condition among Oregon kids. And so there's a huge unmet need when it comes to dental care in the state. And so we got the message loud and clear when we've been talking to folks about this, that needed to be part of this if we were really going to be meeting kids' health care needs. The idea would be that there would be choice.
Yes, Representative Richardson.
When you were focus on oral care, my understanding is that of the 100% of kids that are currently covered, only 34% are receiving preventive dentistry, preventive dental care presently, and this is on a capitation rate. So that means that the state's paying for 100%, but only 34% are getting access. Do we have the health access among the dental community, the providers, to provide preventive dental care when we expand this to 100,000? Or another 100,000 kids.
Chairman Sanderson, Representative Richardson, a couple of points. I just want to point out that the capitation rate in the Oregon Health Plan is based on utilization. It's not based on number of enrollees. But I think that you make a very good point, that we have some workforce challenges in the state in terms of recruitment and retention of health providers. Dentists are some of the highest among them. I think that's where you were headed. Do we have the capacity to serve these kids? I think that's certainly something that is part of our larger discussion about health care reform, reducing costs, and helping everybody be able to meet their needs, we need to focus on. The only other point I would make is that later I'll describe in a little more detail a piece of this program that targets some of that preventive care in schools where kids are, and it's not dependent on whether they're covered or not. And we've had some amazing success with what we call a dental sealant program, where we actually are just meeting kids where they are in the school so that parents don't have to take time off work. And that can make an enormous difference in terms of the number of dental caries that kids actually then have going through their lifespan. So I completely agree with you that I think there is an issue in terms of our workforce in healthcare, and it's something that I think Chairman Sanderson plans for her committee to focus on, and there's some things, for example, the governor has worked, has is proposing the legislature considered with respect to rural communities and some loan repayment programs for dentists in particular. So,
Representative Carter?
It sounds to me as if the representative question was more of a motivational question. And if 34% of the 100 are not using it, it doesn't sound like a capacity question. It sounds like an educational strategy issue. And we cannot make people take their kids to the dentist, but at least we can give them access so that in the event that high incidences of kids not going to school because of oral disease becomes one where the school and where the program itself help to encourage parents to take their kids to the dentist, not because of capacity.
We will talk at length, I think, shortly about subsidies based on family income levels for those higher for those middle income families that we're proposing be included in the plan. And I want to make one point here when we say all plans may compete to participate. In terms of the infrastructure for delivery, the kids that would come into the Oregon Health Plan, those some 68,000 kids that are under 200% of the federal poverty level, those kids would be in our Oregon Health Plan program, as we've described, and they would also be served by the providers that are currently part of the network in the Oregon Health Plan, the managed care providers. We currently, the last I think I heard, we were someplace between 75 and 80% of all enrollees in the Oregon Health Plan are in our managed care system, and so those kids would be served through the managed care organizations that serve your communities today. For this particular private insurance product, for families above 200% of the federal poverty level, we would be opening up for a competitive RFP the opportunity to participate, and we fully expect the managed care plans to participate in that competition, as well as some other plans that would, so they could also, the children in those families that are in middle income levels could also be served by that same network. So again, building on current infrastructure was a really strong emphasis in terms of how the plan design was created. The issue of affordability is one that that we talked quite a bit about with families and among ourselves and with stakeholders. And I know that it's an issue that I've talked to several of you about already. And I want to just kind of spend a minute, if I could, here and help. Just kind of paint a picture in terms of the background. What we were striving for with this plan was to really reduce barriers for families that don't currently have insurance. And certainly the cost of care is a barrier to some families today, and we've talked a little bit about that. So our goal, as we were looking at, you know, what families, at what level the state would share responsibility for health care with middle-income families, we were looking at affordability and what could families actually afford. And so we actually put together an analysis, and this is in the packet of materials that we handed out to supplement our presentation today, but the Office of Health Policy and Research put together an analysis about healthcare affordability in Oregon. And at its highest level, what we did, or what they did through this analysis, and Heidi Allen is here, and I just want to compliment her on this work because it was really fantastic. Looking at family size, looking at income level, and then looking at the cost to actually make ends meet in the state of Oregon, separating families by those who live in rural versus those who live in urban communities, we applied a formula that the Economic Policy Institute provides states and looked at things like housing, food, childcare, transportation, to calculate at the end of every month how much quote disposable income do we estimate a family may have to pay for things like health care. I think it's really important to make a couple of points, and there is detail in the handout about what actually the assumptions were. The last page in particular talks to how the assumptions around housing, food, transportation, what was included. The bottom line, which is reflected in the slides, that this analysis showed us is that in rural communities in this state, their kids are not, the families of kids, it's not until families are at income levels of 200% or higher that they actually have money in their pocket after they've paid all of their bills. And it's not very much money. It's $129 at 200% of the federal poverty level. I want to make a couple of points. This analysis doesn't include things like debt. So if a family happens to carry student loans or happens to have credit card debt, that is not calculated in terms of those basic costs before getting to that disposable income. So that disposable income, quote unquote, would be needed to pay off any outstanding debt that the family had to pay. But in rural communities, I think I think this was very, very informative for us. And then here's the same analysis for urban communities in the state. Costs of living, according to our analysis, are much higher, and it isn't until families are making 250% of the federal poverty level or higher that they have discretionary income that we estimate that they do. Now, when we went around, when the Medicaid Advisory Committee held its public hearings across the state, I was fortunate enough to be able to attend two of those. I did not attend all six. But in the Medicaid Advisory Report, which is available on the web, and if anybody would like that link, I'm happy to provide it to you, there are detailed descriptions of the minutes that those meetings, But we unanimously heard from families that this analysis was very conservative and that, in fact, their costs of child care and housing were much, much higher than we had estimated in this particular analysis. I think those two areas in particular people spoke with us about also, but in any community, different folks would tell us, well, I spend much more than this on food, or I spend much, much more than this on transportation because gas, the price of gas has gone up so much in my community. And so we felt like this analysis really gave us a very conservative estimate of what some families actually do have at the end of the month, and it also does not account for some expenses which I think many of us would say are part of the cost of living. For example, families who have student loans or who have more than one child and the child happens to be younger. When I was looking at this analysis, I was thinking of my own experience. I have a young child who is under the age of two, and the cost for her care is much higher than a child who is 4 years old, which is the estimate that this particular analysis uses. So we're not saying it's perfect, but I think it paints a general picture for people around this issue of affordability that really provided us with the backdrop for the framework that we're proposing in terms of income levels and the amount of subsidy a family would receive. This next slide really shows, and I also provided this to you in the form of a handout. It's this handout. It looks like a chalkboard. And this slide show is available on the governor's website, and I'm happy to get a hard copy to any of you who would like one. But this shows both by the federal poverty level, the number of additional kids potentially of that 117,000 we could cover. It gives you some examples of the family income levels at each tier, and then the proposal that is funded through the governor's recommended budget actually subsidizes families, as we said, on a sliding scale. So families would share more and more of the responsibility for their care as their income level got higher. This is designed to show you what, based on an estimated monthly premium of $160, what a family might expect to pay per child. So if you were living in a family where your income was between 200% of the federal poverty level and 250, so for a family of four, that's between $40,000 and $50,000, it would cost you $24 per month to cover each child in that family. And on down as your income level goes up. Now I'm just going to be very candid. This is a very difficult policy question, I think, that we all have to really grapple with. At what level do we subsidize families, and up to what income levels do we subsidize them? As I said, when we were out and about the state, the feedback that we got unanimously was that working class families, even at what to some of us kind of are struck as sort of those high, quote, higher income levels, are really struggling to be able to afford health care for their kids. And if you look at the number of uninsured kids in each category, it's not until you get up to 300% of the federal poverty level that the number of kids at each income bracket starts to sort of go down in terms of the number of uninsured. So you can see that, you know, I think that the feedback we were getting anecdotally from families based on their real-life experience, which you also heard, I know, on Monday, is reflected in the data that the state office collects about where those uninsured kids are. And so we put a proposal on the table for you to consider about how much families could afford per child per month and at what level you might consider subsidizing those families.
Erin, I think this is an important slide because it is a good policy question. And what that slide's telling me is that a basic price for one kid to be covered by health insurance with no subsidy is $160.
That is the estimate that we currently have made. We won't know for sure how much that premium will be until we actually go out for bid on the contract.
And if I may, Chairman Mona Sanderson, to give you an idea, with no subsidy whatsoever, just to give you some sense of what the cost of family coverage might be running in the state, we estimate the monthly premium for family coverage in Oregon is somewhere between $900 and $1,100 a month.
For the whole family.
For the whole family.
Madam Chair.
Yes,
Senator Clinton. You are exactly right. I'm have helped my daughter. Has a 12-year-old son, and her monthly premium is $859. I'm helping, having right now out of pocket to help two children who are working. One has two children, and that one has one child, and their monthly premium is above $800.
This slide is designed to show you a different way of looking at these program options and when we expect to be able to draw down and maximize our federal dollars. We plan to, if Healthy Kids passes, we plan to ask the federal government for approval to share in the cost of the program up to 300% of the federal poverty level. Other states already have received approval up to that income level, so we're fairly confident that Oregon would be approved as well. The last piece that we've already talked a little bit about, so I'll go through quickly, there is a component to this that we really feel strongly about related to reaching out to families, particularly those who should be enrolled in the programs we have today but who are not. But we also feel like it's important to get, you know, to reach out to take into account that other families, middle-income families, may not know that that this program is available to them. And so we, the proposal that is in front of you proposes to work with local partnerships, basically pass through the state down into local communities, contracts to help organize a community around meeting kids' health care needs. And we would hope that those community coalitions would be outreaching to families with uninsured kids, would be helping families actually go through the enrollment process and stay enrolled in a health plan. We also put some policy into this program that is designed to address some of those other barriers that we've already talked about, but also strike a balance between, especially on the issue of crowd out, between wanting to make sure the group of kids that we're really targeting are those kids who today don't have any coverage. In this handout that you have with you that's has the Healthy Kids Plan Breaking Barriers at the top, goes into a little bit more detail about this. We also gave you a copy of our new of our draft proposed application, which has gone from 11 pages to 2, which we hope will make a significant difference. The legislature last interim began a policy shift in the state of extending the period of enrollment from 6 to 12 months. That's what private coverage plans. That's the period of enrollment for private coverage, and it just makes sense given what we know about why kids sometimes aren't enrolled in the plan to do the same thing for Healthy Kids. We did include a recommendation around a 2-month uninsurance requirement. We've talked already quite a bit about that, and then we also are proposing in our S-CHIP program, and again, remember, this is just a funding mechanism. We do currently have a $10,000 asset test for those kids who happen to fall into the income categories and ages in that area. we felt, you know, the goal here is to get all kids enrolled in the program and to eliminate barriers that might come in the way of that. For many of these middle-income families, actually accruing assets is their key and their path to self-sufficiency, and we felt like that was an important policy to help move forward. But this also really reduces the administrative burden both for families who have to prove the amount of assets that they have, and administrative burden for the state that has to go through the process of verifying that. And we just felt like at the cost-benefit analysis of what it would cost and take to actually verify assets versus the number of folks that would come back and actually exceed an asset limit that we've already set at 10,000 was very minimal. There are some key elements of this plan that are focused on the issue that also has come up today around access, and that is, getting back to the point about not just having an insurance card, but also trying to make a difference and meet kids' health care needs where they are. The governor's budget is proposing to continue what the state already has put into place in terms of a network of school-based delivered health care. We currently have 44 school-based health centers in 17 counties. Two more will come online before the end of the biennium, one here in Salem, in Marion County, and one in Wheeler County. The Healthy Kids program proposes to expand that network by about 13 new centers. We also, along the lines of what I already discussed with respect to the need for dental care, want to make sure that as we're looking at the access issue and the emphasis on prevention and avoiding some of those high costs down the line, want to expand the dental sealant program that counties and the state currently partner in together today. And we also want to make sure that all kids in this program have access to a nurse advice line. There is really great data about the role that nurse advice line can play in helping us avoid emergency department care and get kids' health care needs met in more appropriate settings. As we've talked a little bit about funding for Healthy Kids, the idea is to maximize the federal dollars available to us to most efficiently use the dollars that we invest at the state level for the program. The proposal in front of you in House Bill 2201 does include an increase in tobacco tax dollars, but also families are being expected in this proposal to pay their fair share based on income. And this just summarizes, and I'm trying to hurry because I know we've taken too long.
No. Just to explain to the committee, we can go till 1, and I know some of you need to eat because you have 1 o'clock meetings, but I do plan to go till 1, and that as you leave, just when you're eating, turn on the TV and watch the testimony, okay?
I have some questions.
All right, yes, Representative Greenlink and then Representative Richardson.
Karen, I want to ask, we'll have much more of the discussion on the tobacco tax and how it fits in the Revenue Committee, because 2201 is scheduled to go from the Health Care Committee to the Revenue Committee, but I do want to ask one question. On the slide before the last one, you have some things that are like the nurse advice line and the sealant program and a variety of other things that aren't specifically in the bill. And my understanding is that, and I'd like a comment on this, that the tobacco tax will be covering the specific health plan issues, the Healthy Kids issues, the Medicaid match and the FEOP part of the program. But the governor's budget assumes some other things related to this and other health programs in for use of the tobacco tax. I just want some assurance that in this year and in years forward, the tobacco tax will be sufficient to cover the basic components of the Healthy Kids program. Is that your
Chair Greenlink? It is. I will speak in high level at a high level about this because I think it'll be. I think obviously this will be a big ways and means discussion,
well,
but the Healthy Kids.
Well.
That's right. We currently estimate that in the first biennium of implementation of the tobacco tax increases the governor's proposing, that we would have approximately $182 million to spend on prevention and to fully fund the Healthy Kids plan, and that will cover the cost of first biennium plus cover the cost of some other things health related for Healthy Kids. The second biennium, the estimate that we have received in terms of tobacco tax revenue available to the state to spend on these programs will cover full implementation of Healthy Kids, and that's to the tune of we're currently estimating somewhere between 190 to $200 million of a state obligation around the Healthy Kids Plan once it is fully, fully implemented.
Thank you. And we will hear a lot more about it in other committees.
Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Madam Chair. There's a couple of questions that I've got in my mind. One, I'd like to follow up on this discussion. Presently, we're anticipating $182 million or so of tax revenue in the next biennium, and $54 million of it is going toward this plan. And then the ramp up, I think you said it's 100. You figure 180 to 200 million. Our legislative fiscal office indicated for the 09-11 time that we figured maybe 142 million. The rest of the tobacco tax money that's not being used this current biennium is already being allocated. So, is it what you're saying that in the next biennium, those allocations are just going to go away and the money's going to come back to fund this plan? Because if we continue with the same basic funding scheme in 09-11 that we have now, there's going to be about a $70 million shortfall.
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, we've been having these discussions also with the Ways and Means co-chairs and with the Legislative Fiscal Office, and I think that we are going to have discussion about whether beyond fully funding the prevention element of the tobacco prevention efforts and fully funding Healthy Kids, the legislature wants to use those extra tobacco tax dollars. And I want to just make one clarification. About $80 million of the tobacco tax dollars would be necessary for Healthy Kids the first biennium.
Okay.
It's split actually between two agencies, so it's important to know that. Part of it is going into the DHS budget, and part of it is going over to the Office of Private Health Partnership budget. I think you might just have the DHS number. But in any event, I think that's a discussion, again, a policy discussion for the Ways and Means process in terms of whether you want to use those other tobacco revenue that aren't required for the prevention and the Healthy Kids Plan for other things this biennium, or whether you want to do something else with them.
Can I ask a different line? Mm-hmm. This is strictly a policy issue, and that is that in the governor's handout regarding this, and there's nothing mentioned today, he makes it clear that there'll be no child barred based on citizenship. And I come from a pretty conservative district that thinks that people ought to be legally here in Oregon before they get taxpayer-supported benefits. And apparently that's not what is being contemplated here. What do you suggest that those of us that represent citizens that think that we should only be serving those that are legally in Oregon, you know, what do we tell them about this plan?
I think this plan is designed to offer all children in Oregon the opportunity to have health coverage. And I think that today already all Oregonians, taxpaying Oregonians, are paying for all of the kids in the state who don't have insurance. And we're paying a pretty penny and the highest kind of cost because they're ending up in the emergency room. And so I think as this initiative is really structured for all kids, we would say that this is the right thing to do in terms of covering all of our kids. It's also the most cost-effective thing to do.
Okay. The next question deals with the affordability issue. I saw the study, and that is very helpful, by the way, to see when the kind of the cutoff line is on when you can really get by and then when you have some excess money. And I come from a large family. We could have qualified for all kinds of benefits our whole life. But a lot of people don't go to the government for assistance merely because they can qualify. And so when you get to 350%, for instance, and you're looking at, for a family of four, $70,000 worth of income, there's a lot of people in my district that are going to say, hey, that's about priorities and where you choose to spend your money. And so shouldn't they be responsible to pay for their own health care instead of having families be subsidizing families making $60,000 or $70,000 so that they can have their kids have, you know, dental and optical and health and everything, when they're trying to work and pay for their own way without going to the government for subsidization? And so is this just a philosophical policy difference? I mean, what, I know you said it's a difficult one to deal with, but 350% with no consideration for the fact that people, you know, like, do you have your cable or do you insure your kids? Do you go to the dentist or do you pay for, you know, drugs, tobacco, other things? These are all choices that families make, and are we not essentially embracing people's choices? They spend money that is a lower, that should be a lower priority than taking care of their own kids.
I think I have two perspectives on that. One is that I think, again, when we looked at the income level, and we weren't looking at the gross income level the family had available. What we really tried to focus on was that estimate around discretionary income and how, and what that looked like. And what these examples don't show you, for instance, is what about a single father with two children, both of whom are in daycare? And you calculate each family situation looking very different, and you end up with different amounts of discretionary income at the end of the day. And as I mentioned, I think when we went out around the state, people were telling us that we had estimated those amounts of discretionary income to be much too high. And so families, I think those 2,500 kids that currently are in that category of uninsured kids between 300 and 350% of the federal poverty level, there are about 2,500 of them. I think I don't know, but I think you would probably hear from those families that they don't feel like they have the choice to buy health care today. I also just want to make the quick point that they will not be getting their health care for free, that the proposal is to subsidize them only up to a certain percentage point. And the bill specifically does not dictate the amount of subsidy that would be prescribed. Again, we wanted to leave that decision to legislative discussion, and so the bill, I believe it's in Section 6, actually gives discretion to you all through the Ways and Means process again to really set those subsidy levels, although it does say in the bill that we will not subsidize families at higher incomes than 350. The only last point I would make, I think, again, is that the purpose that when we really were struggling with this question, we had to go back to what is the overall goal that Oregon wants to achieve by implementing this program. And the focus of our goal was on these kids. We would love to have Oregon be a state where we had not a single child without insurance. And if income level and the amount of discretionary income or the cost of health care was going to be a barrier for a family, we wanted to make a policy recommendation that you consider eliminating that barrier.
Yes.
Final follow-up?
Follow-up.
Just one. Thank you. Earlier on, you said that kids without insurance are one half as likely to see a doctor or get preventive care. And if I have that correct, and so if that's the case, that means that half the kids who don't have insurance are getting some sort of health care and preventive care, and so I assume that that would include federally qualified health clinics, FQHCs, and other sources of medical care. And so the focus is always on, we have 117,000 children without insurance, not 117,000 children without health care. And so I'm wondering why doesn't seem to be any kind of coordination with the reality that the federal government has fostered the creation of federally qualified health care centers. We have clinics in Portland and elsewhere, that community-based clinics that provide health care to the kids, and those seem to be completely out of this discussion. Can you help me understand that?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Richardson, I actually don't think that that kind of preventive care in that setting is not included here. In fact, federally qualified health clinics provide services not just to the uninsured, but often also to Oregon Health Plan eligible individuals. And so in terms of the kinds of reimbursement that those clinics would be receiving, if we are able and we are successful at actually enrolling the children who should be in our current programs but who are not, I think those clinics will actually really benefit from this program, where today they're not getting any kind of reimbursement for those kids, but instead then they would be eligible for reimbursement through the state. But I guess the other point I would just make is that preventive care is very, very important, and I think we really as a state want to make sure that where it's available that we're taking advantage of it, because we all know it's more cost effective. But those clinics and that system is not really designed to meet all kids' health care needs. And I think even the providers in those clinics would say that one of their struggles is that they really work very hard in those clinics to become connected to larger health systems so that they can refer children, refer adults in for specialty care, for surgery, for emergent care that they cannot meet, a need that they can't meet in that community-based clinic setting. And so I think you're right that we aren't proposing to totally redesign the health system, but I do think that the role that very important safety net plays is taken into account as we've looked at the structure of the program, but we also believe that there are other pieces that need to be taken into account as well.
Representative Richardson, if I may add, too, just one, you know, in terms of what you want to buy, when we, and the question has always been, should it be insurance coverage or should it be episodes of care? And, you know, I would just throw out the observation that if you go to and have a child who has to be admitted to a hospital, I think probably your average cost per admission in the state is probably $10,000 plus. You could pay that, and you'd have one episode of care. But with coverage, you're covering a child, in these cases, something in the range of $2,000, $2,400 a year. You're covering them for any care that may need any need that for care that may arise during the course of that year. So I think that's the other side of why there has been an emphasis placed on trying to get coverage for people is we could go in and simply compensate for a single episode of care, but the point is you're trying to buy year-round access to the care that's needed and its variations.
Thank you. Okay. Yes. Oh, yes. Representative Bonamici. Thank you. I'm between microphones. I'm not sure where to lean.
We got you.
Thank you. I have a question that I thought of when Representative Richardson asked his question about the constituents in his district and what are they going to think about this. And I know we've all talked not only during the time leading up to our election, but now about these cost savings by providing preventive care and how expensive it is for children when they do need to get their care in emergency rooms. And I wondered if you've done any estimates or studies that talk about the cost savings under assuming that Healthy Kids Plan is in effect, and I'm not asking where those savings will go necessarily, but just something that we can go back and talk to our constituents about. Look at all the money that's going to be saved because we don't have all of those children getting their health care, their primary care in emergency rooms and more expensive clinics.
One way to look at that is to look at the amount of cost shift that the system is currently supporting today. And by cost shift, that term in healthcare refers to the amount of care that the amount of money that those of us with insurance are paying for those of us that don't have it. And today in Oregon, there is a Families USA study that was done in 2005 that estimated that at that time in 2005, the average family premium in Oregon was around $11,000 per year, and that about $1,128 of that amount was actually buying care for the uninsured. And that amount is expected to go up. They did a second projection in 2010 where they were estimating that, in fact, then we would all be paying closer to $2,000 a year for the uninsured, each and every one of us. And so one of the things that I think is one way I think to respond to the cost avoidance question is to look at the amount of cost shift that the insured among us are actually sustaining today. I don't know if you have anything else.
Well, the only thing I would add to that and would be that, you know, Healthy Kids is not in and of itself designed to be the thing that fixes the healthcare system in terms of getting it to be efficient, getting it to run properly, getting it to have high quality and efficiency. And so those efforts don't stop just because we bring kids into the system. We, all of us, and you in particular in the legislature, are going to be wrestling with those alligators for a long time in terms of how can we deal with bringing economic discipline into the healthcare system beyond where it is today, and also how can we improve the quality of the care that's delivered from that system as well. So the state is dedicated to that, what we call value purchasing, which is to get the best value out of the dollars we do spend in healthcare, as is the business community, as we've seen recently, if any of you had the opportunity to attend a recent healthcare summit. I would also mention that, you know, I think business leaders do think this is the right direction to go in. The Oregon Business Council and its Oregon business plan this year has recommended specifically that we take this step in Oregon, that we use a tobacco tax and use it to cover all kids in Oregon.
Okay. Thank you very much. I want to continue on unless
I do you, have you,
okay, Representative Flores, and then Representative Maurer, and then we will move on to public testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. and Chair Greenlee. I know I appreciate your patience with the probative value of some of these questions, because I really do think that since it is a significant policy consideration for the state of Oregon, even what might appear to be a dumb question needs to be addressed.
There are no dumb questions.
In that context, Ms. Kelly Seal, the draft of the application, it caught my attention. And I wonder if you could tell us if there was discussion around or consideration of you have name, relation, date of birth, and a question as to whether a listed person is pregnant. Now, was there contemplation about if one of the children within a family happens to be pregnant and delivers a child, would then that child of a child in the family be eligible for under this scenario, under this program?
Chair Greenlee, Chairman Sanderson, Representative Flores, yes, the program is designed to cover all children, and so it's possible that if a teen child under the age of 19 were to give birth to a child, they would both be covered under the Healthy Kids Plan.
Yes, and Representative Maurer, and then Representative Bruin.
Madam Chair, my question is, I guess I'm having questions or concerns about this connection between cigarettes and healthy kids, and you know, I guess my first question is do you deem this as the highest priority in the governor's budget?
Oh, she better not answer that question.
I'm actually not the right person. I'm the Human Services Policy Advisor, and I think, you know, I think the governor has laid out pretty clearly in his budget documents that he has several priorities, but this is certainly among them.
Okay. And so why was the issue of the cigarette tax addressed, or why was that the target for the funding mechanism?
Both Ree and I are excited to answer this. Do you want to start?
Well, I have said before that I actually look at the tobacco tax as not as much as a tax as a health program. The reality is that smoking is related to some of the top causes for healthcare expenses, that we have huge amounts of evidence and data now that show us the relationship between that and heart disease, cancer, et cetera. And also, we also know, because of the opportunities that the states have now had to put up tobacco prevention programs, that raising the cost of cigarettes is the number one deterrent to having to preventing youth from starting to smoke in the first place. So one of the additional benefits that we buy with the tobacco tax is the prevention of some 29,000 plus kids from beginning to smoke in the first place. It also acts as a deterrent and helps smokers who are on the bubble, so to speak, stop smoking to the tune of 12 to 15,000 of them as well. Clearly, there have been arguments about this, but one of the more interesting factoids for me is that if we were to try and cover the cost of smoking-related health care through tobacco totally, we would probably have to put a tax somewhere in the neighborhood of $11 per pack to get anywhere close to what that cost is. And it's a cost, and you know, when we talk about health care cost containment and trying to bring the cost of health care down, one of the better and easiest things that you can do is to raise the tax on tobacco, because with that you get an enormous savings down the line, because you don't have those tobacco-related illnesses and diseases coming in. So I always like to think of it as a health care program rather than a tax per se, because we get enormous benefits from it, and from an element or a weed that is costing us enormous, millions and millions and millions of dollars in our healthcare system.
Follow-up. And I applaud those efforts. And I've read cover to cover the Oregon Tobacco Prevention Program. And so it seems to me that the more money we put into tobacco prevention, that the more benefit we get from those programs, and the number of PACs decline, and as dollars decrease, which they did in the recession, that decrease, it still decreases, but at a smaller rate. More money, it expands. And so, to me, that what we end up, and what we hope to end up with, is no funding stream for healthy kids.
And
that's the end state. So then I scratch my head and say, well, then where do we go? Where do we go for funding? And why aren't we just going to the general fund today for this program, as opposed to imposing a tobacco tax? Because we've got a House bill here that we're not discussing today, but separates it out. And so I guess I have that whole question of a stable funding source in the future.
Mm-hmm.
To me, it just doesn't pass the common sense test, but I may be wrong.
Well, I think you're right. If we do have the opportunity to raise this tax, then clearly we will have some diminution in consumption and therefore a reduction in the revenue. And that has been accounted for in the costing out and the budgeting and estimating of revenue, et cetera, in this plan. We have factored in a decline in consumption. The other thing, and again, I know sometimes I'm too direct, but not in any way trying to be glib, but I've learned, having concentrated in the area of healthcare now for longer than I'd like to admit, that given the growth rate in healthcare, there is no funding source that you don't have to revisit. And in the case of tobacco, we're a long way from running out of the revenues that's generating, unfortunately. We're years and years down that road before we have to do that. And in the meantime, we're going to have to revisit healthcare financing in toto, along with those cost containment issues. So there's no ducking that bullet in terms of grappling with the cost of health care. And again, making children wait until we find that silver bullet doesn't seem to me to be the logical equation either.
Representative Bruin.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Two questions, two different lines. The first one, Rhea, if I may, to you, and this is a little bit of a follow-up on Representative Maurer's line of questioning. I have similar concerns that Representative Maurer has regarding the relevancy of a tobacco tax to, you know, that's coming from a few, that ostensibly to a program that benefits everybody, not just the kids, but it's obviously a statewide, I mean, something that benefits the entire state. Healthy kids benefits the entire state. I've often thought, and this is more of a comment, but I'd love to hear if this has been discussed in the governor's office. You mentioned that if you were to fully burden the cost of tax-wise, fully burden the cost of a pack of cigarettes to cover the public health care expense, to offset, if you will, the public health care expense that is caused by smoking and smoking-related illnesses, would be $11 a pack. That may be true. I mean, that's if it's $5, $8, $11, whatever it is. How much thought has gone into the policy question? Let's do that. Okay, if truly the cost of smoking on the public health care systems in Oregon is $11 a pack, let's make a proposal to raise the tax to cover that cost, which ostensibly would free up a whole bunch of monies that are currently being used in the public health system that we could dedicate toward this plan.
I'll co-sponsor that with you.
And the reason I ask the question, and you know what, I mean, the reason I ask the question, it's from a philosophical perspective, it's a lot easier for a lot of us to get. You got two questions here. You've got the Healthy Kids Plan, which has pros and cons, but all of us want to see kids get insured. Then you have this funding structure, which a lot of us are scratching our heads over. And the reason I ask, doesn't it make, but from a philosophical perspective, it's a lot easier for a lot of us to say, hey, smokers ought to pay every cent that they cost the system, okay? But something that benefits the entire state, shouldn't we all pay for?
Well, I'd try and come at that a couple of ways.
First of all, I think the argument of why tax a few for the benefit of many, and I think my previous remarks really spoke to the fact that the majority have been paying for the minority who have given us disproportionate expense. But the other thing is to point out to you that currently in Oregon, the tobacco taxes are funding health care. The major recipient of tobacco taxes is the Oregon Health Plan. So there's plenty of precedent, not only in Oregon, but across the country, to use quote unquote the sin taxes towards health care. And I think the other important thing in this discussion, and you know, why not $11? I mean, I think, you know, you have a taxable source, and there's a pragmatism that goes along with all of this. But the other cautionary, I think, in trying to say, you know, make the smokers pay for their own, et cetera, kind of thing, is that, you know, one of the problems we're experiencing right now is about our whole movement around the sense of insurance as a social contract among members of a community, that we would all put our money in the pot in the eventuality that one of us would get sick, it would cover us. And so to that extent, you know, we see health care as one of those things that we do, but recently we have seen a lot of people's mentality move towards sort of the user fee mentality. And that may work for maybe amusement, entertainment type things, but it really doesn't work very well in health care. And because of genetic situations, et cetera. So I think as we go through this, I think you're very correct to say this is a really important policy decision that you're making, and that you do want to use public funds where you can to broaden the access so that all of us have that access, and at the same time you don't want to disproportionately burden a particular thing, because some people have extraordinary and catastrophic things happen to them, and this is an opportunity to maintain, I think, one of the keystones of how we do finance health care, and that is it is a shared responsibility, it's a community responsibility, and that we all have a part to play in it, the sick and the healthy as well.
Senator Carter.
Madam Chair, I think for the sake of the committee, that I do know that the Department of Human Services over the years have looked at cigarette-related diseases and can better tell us how much we are spending for those people who become ill in the system as a result of cigarette-related diseases through the Department of Human Resources. Our budget is not $12 billion for nothing. A large portion of those dollars do go to people who have suffered particular diseases as it relates to cigarettes. And so I think it would be the rightful place for it to be. But I also think that it's a political question as well as a political decision that determines why we use cigarette dollars for health care. And this body has done it over the years, and it was a decision that all of us as legislators have decided that's what we wanted to do. So you might want to be careful in answering these guys' questions up here, because there's certainly political decisions, and let your governor answer them so you won't be in trouble. Because that's exactly what these kind of questions are. They are political questions that the governor needs to come before this committee and answer on for you guys along those lines. But for many of us that asked this question years ago in terms of why would we use the dollars that comes from master settlement as well as tobacco, we said that the cost that other taxpayers are using to offset the cost of people with cigarette-related diseases are the highest proportion of the dollars that we use in the Department of Human Resources. And so that's exactly what happens. So in looking at one of the softest ways to raise money to pay for taxes, so you guys, Republicans, won't feel bad about voting for it, and some of our conservative friends in the Democratic Party won't feel bad about supporting, is that we have all of our kids in the system. And so who can talk about kids, whether they're legal or illegal? But most of the kids here are legal because their parents had them in this country, in this state. So I don't think we can look at a kid and say, we're not going to pay for you because you're illegal. Yes, the kid is sick. Well, guess what? You're going to pay.
It's just that you're going to pay an emergency room, which is going to cost you much more money than if you would give them access on the front end of it. So it just makes sense to do this in looking at why we do for our kids. You let one doctor in this state turn down a kid, and you and come from your district, and you know what you're going to say? Doctor, why didn't you take care of this kid? It doesn't matter whether the kid is legal or illegal. Why didn't you take care of him? And that's going to be the question that all of us in the Oregonians are asking. Margaret Carter, how dare you turn down a kid in the inner city for health insurance because the kid was not legal? They're going to unelect my butt real fast, and they need to. And they need to.
Not a chance.
Oh, they will do that. Because you were so unreasonable, you're going to determine that just because the kid is illegal, parents are illegal, that you don't take care of them. I don't think so.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Carter. Now, I want to make sure that Representative Bruin question.
I have one more question, but I just want to respond real quick to Senator Carter. I hope you know that, or at least I hope you know that I'm certainly not asking any questions that are construed as a political setup. That's giving me way too much credit as a political strategist.
No.
I wish I were that smart, actually.
Madam Chair, I would never insult your intelligence.
No, I know you're not.
But what I am saying is that all of us, when it comes down to taxes, feel a little uncomfortable about doing it. But that this has been deemed a soft tax by the business community and by everybody in terms of this. So I didn't mean if I was insulting. It was totally Representative Flores and Representative Bruin, it was not intended to be that way. It's just some cajoling among us as legislators, because it is a legislative
issue. All right, I'd like to move. Representative Flores, you have
All right. Question. I go back to this goes back to this is a more narrow question, and probably to you, Aaron. The question of, we have basically the starting pool of kids that will be eligible is 117,000, which is, an estimate, and that's before we talk about crowd out or move in or anything else. But 117,000 kids, right now, it looks like 60,000 of these kids are currently eligible for OHP Plus. They're just not in it. And part of this program is, okay, here's some things we're going to, here's a series of things we're going to implement to help bridge that gap. My question is, once again, I'm not, this is not to denigrate anyway the overall affordable, healthy kids plan, but what of those policy priorities that are related to getting kids on the plan, why can't we reform the OHP Plus to implement those? Notwithstanding anything else we do on the larger healthy kids plan, what's preventing us from taking those good plans, good ideas, and saying, great, and hopefully, we may move something this session, I hope we'll move something this session, but even if we didn't, what could we do with Oregon Health Plan to help get those 60,000 kids insured? And is there anything prohibiting us from doing that?
I think the short answer is no, there's nothing prohibiting you from doing that.
Okay.
Representative Flores.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I guess I am responding somewhat to Senator Carter. In the context of these are political questions, indeed they are, mm-hmm. but not for the purposes of division, but each one of us are represented by our districts to ask those political questions. We have philosophical distinctions, absolutely, Republicans and Democrats. That's what sets us on both sides of the scale. But I would hope that in that context you understand that I think we are trying to unpack and get to some very legitimate understanding and clarity on issues that I think need to be asked and addressed for purposes of those people who sent us here to ask those very questions.
No, Madam Chair, okay. I totally agree. Madam Chair,
Senator Carter.
Yes.
I want to keep the protocol here.
I think that you're totally right. I would never try to censor what you say, but I tell you what I will say, and that's exactly what I said, that these people need to be careful how they answer the questions and refer them to their governor, because he is the equivalent to you and the people that you have to answer to. And I firmly mean that. Because it makes sense. These are policy people, not legislators or not political entities like we are. And I feel that it's very appropriate what you ask. And I think that you should ask what your constituents sent you here to ask, because I will do that too. And so I meant no intent in terms of the political question meant to be as a division. But it is a political question, however, and they do need to be careful how they answer that question.
Thank you that we can clear that deck.
Thank you so very much for coming. And now I'm going to quickly move on, and I know that Dr. Linda Solares from the Essential Health Clinic, and I think Dr. Steiner had to leave, correct? No, you're here, Dr. Elizabeth Steiner. Why don't you two come up real quick and give your testimony? And like I said, committee, if you need to get lunch, come back, fine. Turn on the TV upstairs and watch us. Go ahead.
I'll defer to Dr. Steiner.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Dr. Elizabeth Steiner. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Academy of Family Physicians. We're a specialty society representing over 1,000 family physicians in Oregon, serving your constituents with first-class health care across the state. I'm here today to testify on behalf of the OAFP in support of the Healthy Kids proposal, which we see as a very important first step in providing health care for all Oregonians. Family physicians see patients of every age with every medical condition. We provide what we colloquially refer to as womb-to-tomb medical care, deliver babies, take care of children, see their parents and their grandparents, and provide end-of-life care. And we know firsthand the effects of uninsurance on children and families across this state. In particular, we see this in our rural and underserved communities. We know that, as the saying goes, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. And as the previous witnesses testified, we know that implementing this kind of health care plan will save the state and taxpayers and citizens who have private insurance millions of dollars over the course of the program by providing necessary preventive care before the child ends up in the emergency department or seriously ill. Children and parents are particularly receptive to prevention measures and to early treatment because they have the habit installed through the necessary immunizations that they get as part of their childhood programs, immunizations which are required for school entry and which are, fortunately, in this state, fully provided for by the Vaccine for Children program. And their parents are eager to get health care for their children. We see parents in our offices every day saying, I'd like to get my child seen for this. Can you see them at the same time? Or can we talk about this issue we're dealing with as a family to help our family eat more healthily, to help our family manage our child's asthma? And they want to do that for their children, but their children often don't have insurance, and this program would help alleviate that problem. This is particularly important now with rising rates of asthma, obesity, and obesity-related diseases such as type 2 diabetes. Family physicians and other physicians who care for children will be able to help those families quickly and easily when the children are all insured. We believe that we can provide high-quality, first-class preventive or early intervention care for children with unhealthy eating habits, for children who aren't getting enough exercise, for children with asthma, providing them with asthma action plans so they don't end up in the emergency department. Because children with these medical problems who don't have health insurance or who see physicians but don't actually get the medications that are prescribed by those physicians end up missing school. They miss out on exercise. They miss out on other important activities that will help them develop into healthy adults. One of the things that I do with my time is I volunteer at Southwest Community Health Center, which is a safety net clinic for people with no insurance or who are underinsured. And we see lots of children there. I'd like to tell you a little bit about one of those children. Benjamin is an 11-year-old boy whose family has no health insurance at all. And he has asthma. And his family can't afford medications for his asthma. And they can't afford to see a doctor. So they come in to see us and tell us that Benjamin has been in the emergency department 3 times in the past 12 months. Now, I can assure you that that costs a heck of a lot more than any insurance that we could provide for Benjamin, including prescription coverage. We can provide, because we have voucher programs with grants that we've secured, we can provide basic care for Benjamin. We have a lot of volunteers involved. We can provide basic medications for Benjamin. We can keep him out of the hospital for a little bit longer. But this can't go on like this forever. Children like Benjamin cannot continue to miss school, to stay off the playground, to stay off the athletic fields, and have all the health consequences and learning consequences that come with these chronic health problems. Research done even here in Oregon, as your previous witnesses testified, by the Office of Healthcare Research and Health Policy and Research, show that even when children are eligible for insurance, they often don't get it when their parents are eligible. So as I said before, we see healthy kids as a very important first step. And reducing the barriers to getting children enrolled is obviously very important. And we commend the governor's office for putting in these steps to reduce the barriers to getting insurance. Family physicians are very eager to work closely with all people in Oregon to provide first-class care and will be better able to do that when parents are able to bring their children in for high-quality, affordable care that this plan and the care that we provide will allow them to do. So we thank the governor's office and we thank this committee for seriously considering this important initiative on behalf of Oregon's children.
Thank you. Dr. Steiner. Okay, yes, Dr. Mao.
Yes. Madam Chair.
I mean, Representative. Oh, I just jumped into the medical field.
Doctor would be appropriate.
Oh, you got a PhD. Okay.
My question has to do, you know, we talk about emergency room as the access point, and it is the access point. And so I want to get it on the record, and I'm interested in your thoughts about EMTALA, and I don't know the acronym, but it's the emergency management or emergency room. It requires ERs to treat all patients, and how that is an impact in this system, and how that open door policy essentially is kind of a something that really isn't discussed in the public. Do you have any comments about that?
Certainly, Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, Representative Maurer. Thank you for asking that question. I think it's very important. EMTALA, the act that requires emergency departments to see all comers, essentially, anybody who walks through their door gets care, has significant advantages and disadvantages. It means that people who are in need of critical care immediately do get the care that they need. However, it means that because this is the only guaranteed open access point in our entire healthcare system, that it is used, in essence, as a source of primary care, which it isn't, a source of basic urgent care for simple things like ear infections and sore throats, which it shouldn't be, and that has many negative effects. First of all, obviously, the expense. It's a heck of a lot less expensive for me to provide care for a child with an ear infection than for the emergency department to do so, probably a sixth or a seventh the cost at most, including the medications. Second of all is it's crowding out people who truly need emergency services, people with heart attacks or strokes or trauma, from getting those services as quickly as they should. Third of all, it's crowding the system so that everybody waits longer, which keeps parents away from their jobs longer. It requires them to take more sick time. It keeps children out of school longer. All of those effects are really significant and unfortunate and would be significantly alleviated by implementation of universal coverage for children in Oregon.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Sure. I'd like to add my thanks to my constituent and my colleague and my neighbor for hanging in.
Okay, I've got a timer in my hand.
Okay.
5 minutes.
Okay. My name is Linda Nilsson-Solaris, and I'm not a doctor, and I sure don't play one on TV. When I was asked to consider if I'd testify today, I had to think about why I would testify at a healthcare policy hearing. You see, I've been very intentional in my efforts over the years to avoid policy, and after having watched what these folks went through earlier, it reminded me why. I also come from that safety net healthcare world. My professional experience has mostly been working to see the uninsured people get health care. I believe that I tried to do my work in my little world and hope that you policy folks would make it so that I'd be out of a job in the next few years. So I'm going to hold you to that, hopefully. Until December of last year, so just a month or so ago, I was the executive director of the only free clinic in Washington County, the Essential Health Clinic. And when you're out stumping for funds in a nonprofit clinic in Western Washington County, policy may not always be your friend. So it's important for us to focus on what it is that we do, what's the outcome, because helping people always brings support to your organization. I just recently started working with Project Access Now, which is a metro-wide effort to coordinate, track, and celebrate the efforts of volunteer physicians, hospitals, health systems, and other stakeholders that provide free health care for the working poor that don't qualify for Oregon Health Plan and other resources. Project Now does not address policy, but rather aims to make better use of the existing resources. However, in my case, when I realized that when you work long enough in this kind of direct care world, you realize that policy really does matter. Even a wildly successful project access effort, which is where my heart and soul is right now, would not solve the healthcare crisis. So folks in my line of work, our goal is to try to take care of people's needs in the moment with the hope and faith that the healthcare policy will make our efforts unnecessary in a few years, which leads me back to why I've chosen to testify. First of all, I want to express my sincere gratitude to all of you who've been fighting the good fight to improve healthcare in our state. As a healthcare advocate, a concerned citizen, and a mom, I'm honored to have this opportunity to share with you about my experiences working with children in the safety net healthcare system and my hopes for this legislation and other healthcare policy to come. Not everybody gets to do this, so I appreciate this honor. For the last 13 years, I've been personally involved with many children and their families who have not had health insurance. As a medical interpreter, many years ago, I sat with a family in an emergency room as their son recovered from an asthma attack. The parents were frightened for their son's health. Much like Dr. Steiner mentioned, it was the third time that child had been in the emergency room that year. They were also concerned about their mounting medical bills, and they didn't really understand the disease process, and they didn't have the support that they needed medically because their son didn't have a medical home. In my work with the Essential Health Clinic, I had the opportunity to provide case management for a number of children. Just a few examples that jump right out at me when I think over the last few years. First is a 14-year-old girl who had had trouble sleeping and eating pretty much her whole life. And her mother just thought that was normal for her. Never had access to routine health care. She came to the Essential Health Clinic, was referred to an ENT, and found out that she needed a tonsillectomy. Her tonsils were so large they were affecting her ability to swallow and to breathe at night. I'll never forget when her mother came back to the clinic to thank us for help. She said that her daughter was sleeping the whole night through for the first time in her life. Keep in mind, that's a 14-year-old. And I thought the first year of, you know, having children was rough. I remember a 6-year-old boy who had had a low-grade fever and a mild cough for over a month, came to our clinic. Seemed like a virus, but, you know, the pediatrician said, you know, we better send him out for a chest x-ray just in case. Turns out he had double pneumonia. Another 16-year-old girl came to us. She'd had several months of fatigue, you know, very generalized stuff, couldn't really figure out what was going on. So the provider decided to do routine blood work and found out she was suffering from kidney failure, and clearly this had been happening for months. So these are just a few examples that I've personally been involved with where children and their families have suffered needlessly because they didn't have access to routine medical care. I recently took my own 6-year-old to the doctor because she'd had a fever for 3 days. She didn't want to go, and I didn't really want to take her because I didn't want to feel like a silly mom just wasting time if she just had a virus. And I have good health insurance. Money was not an issue for me, and nor was time for that matter. But it's still sometimes difficult to access care. Well, it turns out my daughter had strep throat and an ear infection. Many parents in Washington County have very limited resources for their children when they're sick and no access to routine exams in order to identify problems before they become more serious. How many of those parents wait to seek care for their children? How many of them end up in the ER because their children are more ill than they had imagined? I don't know. But as a mother, it's hard for me to accept that my kids get access to the care that they need and other people's children don't. As a healthcare advocate, it's frustrating to see people get less effective and more expensive care when I know there's a better way. We all know, again, the conversation about the ER. The Healthy Kids Plan acknowledges that all children should have access to healthcare, regardless of the family's income, or their parents' ability to jump through those hoops in order to qualify for health insurance. The truth of the matter is most kids are healthy, and with access to routine exams and occasional urgent care, they really need little attention. The goal here of Healthy Kids Plan is very reasonable. I do have one concern, and that has been alluded to previously also. Providing health insurance to children does not guarantee access to health care. Currently in Washington County, based on my experience, there are not enough pediatricians or family practice folks that are accepting Oregon Health Plan to meet the current demand. So this is one of those devilish details that can make a big difference between good policy and poor outcomes, depending on how it's implemented. So I think this is very logical, attainable, morally justifiable, and if it's implemented in a way that truly increases access to care, their lives will be improved. In the meantime, I'll keep working with lots of amazing people throughout the state to take care of the most vulnerable among us right now. I have every confidence that the Healthy Kids Plan will be the first of many steps that will help me need to find a new career.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay.
All right. Do we? Thank you very much, Dr. Solara. Is Matt Savage or Isaac Holman here? That one took 6.5 minutes, so
3 to 5, okay?
Okay. Good morning. My name is Matt Savage. I'm a student at Lewis and Clark College, and I'm here also to strongly endorse the proposed Oregon Healthy Kids program. Unlike many other college students, I'm fortunate enough to have health insurance due to my parents, but 30% of college students do not have health insurance, according to a study by the Heinz Family Philanthropies and the Cherokee Group in 2002. These students do not get regular checkups, have no other options other than the emergency room if they need medical care. This raises prices for everyone else because emergency room visits are passed on to the consumer. It would be far cheaper for these students to be seen by regular doctors than in a costly emergency room. Students without health insurance also do not receive prescription drugs unless they pay for them out of pocket, which is often too expensive. Many students, like myself, have attention deficit disorder. If I were to go without medication, I would not be able to succeed to my fullest potential as a student. Health insurance is essential to receiving a good education. When students are ill, they need medical attention. Being unnecessarily ill makes it harder to study and harder to succeed later in life. Worrying about your health care also provides unneeded stress to students, making it difficult to excel in school. And according to the previously cited study, students without health insurance are far more likely to drop out of college. College students are the immediate future of Oregon's economy. Without health insurance, many students are forced to work outside jobs to pay for health care. Others go without health care entirely. If we do not succeed in college, we will not succeed after we graduate. In an information economy that increasingly relies on highly skilled workers from Oregon's colleges and universities, we cannot afford for students to fail due to lack of health insurance. It is essential that college students have health insurance and makes them more likely to succeed in college, makes them less likely to drop out, but provides better workers for our growing economy and helps these students succeed later in life. Providing health insurance to college students is part of a healthy and brighter future for Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you. What college?
Lewis and Clark College.
Lewis and Clark. Thank you so much for coming.
No problem.
Hi, my name is Isaac Holman. I'm a student of the Biochemistry and Molecular Biology and Political Economy programs at Lewis and Clark College in Portland. Thank you for giving me a chance to speak here today.
It's an unusual mix, right?
Yeah, I like to mix it up. You know, it keeps me amused when I get to do one thing here and another thing later. But I'd like to speak about, I think the entire initiative here is very important, very urgent even, but I'd particularly like to talk about the school-based health centers and the issue of trust. I think I'm a good person to talk about this because I'm young enough still that I remember what it's like to be an even younger child, but I'm old enough now that I'm able to talk about it a little. Students trust their teachers. It's kind of hard to explain because you don't even have to like the teacher. I've certainly had situations like that where I didn't like the teacher, but you kind of know, particularly in public school. I was in public school all the way through high school, and you just kind of know that they wouldn't be there if they didn't really have your best interests in their heart of hearts. And so it's this entire community of trust. You know, when you go to school, you know that all the adults you're working with, you can trust. And so when you're talking about an issue like healthcare, particularly for the population of students that don't get healthcare right now, trust is important, and because, quite frankly, accessing healthcare can be scary. My parents are both teachers, so I've had, you know, through that program, good health insurance my whole life, but I have had situations where I've been outside of the country, and I had to access a healthcare system that was foreign to me, one that I hadn't accessed previously. In that situation, I even had my parents with me to support me, but it can be pretty intimidating when you don't know what you're doing. It can be pretty scary. I've even had situations in the States with the healthcare system that I have experience with, but when my parents weren't there, and this is in high school, you know, let alone the situation's worse for kids in elementary school and stuff, but even in high school, it can be pretty intimidating to the point where I could just say, you know, it's just a fever, and I might not go, when in 4 days it might be pneumonia, which really is a lot more serious for my health, and it's a lot more serious bill for the system, if, you know, the system is paying for it. with the school system, you know, the public school system, we've got these communities of trust already. They're places where students go on a very regular basis, where they know and see the people that they work with. And so when we've got this opportunity to offer some of the health services within this existing community of trust, it's a very, very powerful tool, not only to make the whole situation easier for children, more comfortable for children, but also to see that they are going in there, they are getting the care that they need to keep them, you know, healthy, lead stronger, healthier lives, to keep them out of the emergency rooms, and that whole gamut that you've been hearing about all day. But that's my opinion, and I'd like to say also, you know, being a young person who is going to be too old by the time this thing would be implemented to directly benefit from it, I think my age group does have a very strong vested interest. You know, the age group that is just now getting old enough to vote for y'all. we value the children very much, and it is something we're paying attention to. So thank you very much.
Oh, I appreciate it so very much. Thanks so much.
I'm sure I'd like to add my thanks to that, and also suggest while you're here testifying on this issue, you might hang around to 1 o'clock and visit the subcommittee on higher ed meeting next door.
Becky Jarvis from the Oregonians for Health Security and Tom Chamberlain from AFL-CIO, are they here? If they're not here, Liz Smith-Curry and Kathy Kaufman.
Hello, my name is Becky Jarvis. I'm here with my son, Zachary Jarvis, who's 3 years old. I live in Aloha. This is my first time testifying, so
welcome. Thank you so much.
I'm here to represent small business owners with private health insurance. My husband and I own a computer service and repair company, and we currently have to purchase private health insurance since we don't qualify for the small employer health insurance. We only have one employee that works part-time for us. And so that's what I'm going to talk about. My son is a special needs child with speech and sensory issues. And so through Northwest ESD, we supplement that with private speech and private occupational therapists. Right now we're currently with Blue Cross. We feel like we're stuck with Blue Cross because we can't change, because my husband had two car accidents 2 years ago where he was rear-ended, and because he sought 6 months of chiropractic treatment, Blue Cross will not allow us to change health plans within their system because of pre-existing conditions. And I know that if we went to any other health care provider, they would probably deny us based on his back injuries. Right now, the cost of Zachary's therapy, we get 30 visits for speech and occupational and physical per calendar year. Once you go through those visits, it's all out of pocket, and they charge you non-insurance rates. So, for example, occupational therapy would be $184 per calendar year or per hour. I know that our medical expenses this year have been huge, but at least I know that this year we'll be able to deduct our medical expenses, since it's over 7% of our adjusted gross income. This year we spent almost $14,000 on medical insurance and out-of-pocket expenses, which I didn't realize till I got prepared for this last night that we had spent that much money. That's the health insurance, that's co-payments, that's mental health coverage that is not covered through private insurance. My husband and I strongly support the Healthy Kids Plan because we feel it'll provide coverage for all of Oregon's children, and I think it's a good start. Even though we have insurance and we feel blessed to have insurance, it is a huge financial burden on our family having to spend $14,000 on medical care this past year.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I think it makes a real difference to us to have a
real situations and the fact that you have a small business and are struggling. That's important for us to know.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, chairs of the committee, members of the committee. My name is Liz Smith-Curry. I'm the policy director for the Oregon School-Based Healthcare Network. And I just want to say that although the governor has proposed expansion of school-based health centers, it is not in the legislation we're discussing today. And so you might wonder why, somebody who provides access to children with or without insurance, cares about whether kids are uninsured. Well, the providers that we work with across Oregon tell me that the kids that they see who are uninsured have much poorer health outcomes than the kids that they see who are insured, although both do have access to quality medical care in the schools. And I think, some of the stories that they tell me say that, there's a young boy, an 8-year-old, who has a meth-addicted mother in recovery, whose biological father is absent. He has all kinds of health and mental health issues. He does not have insurance, and although at the school-based health center he's able to receive quality care for some of his needs, he also has a mental health therapist through the school-based health center, his family cannot afford the ADHD medication that he needs. So that is a person who is not able to attain, some of the modifications that he needs to excel in school and in life. There's another student that we know who came into the school-based health center. Both of her parents work, but they can't afford medical insurance. She had a stomach ache for 2 straight weeks. She finally came in when she literally felt like she was going to die. In fact, it turned out she had a ruptured appendix. And she, had to have 2 surgeries and lots of antibiotics. And the school-based health center staff was able to work their community connections to get her the care and the payment so that the family could get the care that they need. There's another boy who showed up at a clinic with a broken arm. It was the first time he had ever been to a doctor outside of when he was born. And that is very common, that a lot of the times when you have a school-based health center, these are the only medical people they've ever seen in their lives. And as one of the previous people said, in the school, they're very comfortable. They see these people daily, so it's a good experience for them to come and get some medical care. However, the nurse quickly saw that this kid had bone cancer. And, so if he had not broken his arm, that might have not have been caught. So there are many, many examples, and these are examples, Coos Bay, Medford, Pendleton, all over our state, where kids who might have some access to care but who do not have health insurance are not getting the consistent medical treatment that they need. They need to have this. They need to have, more a medical home, and having health insurance is so critical to being able to find and stay in a medical home. So I'd like, I really think that right now Oregon has the opportunity to make it's a historical moment. It's like the bottle bill or public access to beaches. I think that your constituents will look back and be grateful for this time in history, because I really think that it's going to make a difference in the lives of Oregon's children.
Thank you.
Senator Mona Sanderson, Representative Greenlick, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to testify before you today. My name is Kathy Kaufman. I'm the Policy and Communications Director for Children First for Oregon. Children First, if you aren't familiar with us, is a statewide, nonprofit, nonpartisan child advocacy organization, and we're doing everything we can to make Oregon a place where all children thrive. And we believe that the Healthy Kids program will go a long way to contribute to that goal of ours. I want to thank Erin Kelly Seal for referring to the book that we released yesterday, the 2006 County Data Book on Kids, focused this year on health disparities among children. We've heard a lot about the high numbers of children in the state without health insurance and how that inhibits their access to quality care, and how the challenges they face in accessing care affects their life development, how well they'll be able to do in school, how healthy they will be, and how productive they'll be able to be as adults.
What's even more disturbing is that there are certain groups of children that face even greater disparities in care, whether insured or uninsured. But we believe that the Healthy Kids program will go a long way to intervene for children who face disparities. These children are children who are born into low-income families, who come from communities of color, who live in the rural areas of the state, or who have immigrant parents. So through no fault of their own, simply because of the way our health care system doesn't work for them, they face greater health challenges. And they face those greater health challenges at birth, even prenatally. And those challenges are exacerbated. They grow as those children reach adulthood. This is not a fair system. This sets children up for an unfair chance at a healthy and productive life. And we believe that the Healthy Kids program will go a long way to mitigate some of that unfairness for these kids. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much. Okay, Tom Chamberlain, Jane Ellen Weilance, Casey Hahn, John Doer Cormar. That's the order. Go ahead.
Did you have a preference?
No, just who's ever ready, go.
Okay.
You were first.
Chairwoman Mona Sanderson and Chairman Greenlick, thank you for allowing me to testify, and I appreciate all the members of the committees who have stayed throughout the day to listen to this testimony. My name is Jane Ellen Weidance, and I am the Director of Public Policy for the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. We represent the 57 hospitals throughout the state and the patients that they serve every day. And you've heard a lot of information about people showing up in the emergency room and how inappropriate that is, and we'd like to second that. The emergency room is not the appropriate place for people to receive primary care, nor is it the best place for them to receive continuing care as they go forward in their lives. And so we wholeheartedly support getting children covered through health insurance. I do want to point out a couple of things that we think could make this bill a little stronger as you debate the policy implications of the language. Specifically, we would recommend that you eliminate the coinsurance word that's in, I think, Section 7, Sub 2. It says copayment or coinsurance, and from experience working with people with extremely low incomes, coinsurance, it usually means a percentage of a person's cost of the care versus a standard copayment, and that can be a barrier when you're paying a percentage of the bill versus just a set fee. It can be a barrier to people receiving services, and we would like to see a plan that really eliminates any barriers. We also want to stress that we believe in continuity of care, and as people move between uninsured status, hopefully accessing both school-based clinics and federally qualified health clinics and the safety net clinics through the Oregon Health Plan and et cetera, that those children be able to continue to see the primary care physicians and the relationships that they've developed in those primary care facilities, so that we hope that the Office of Private Health Partnerships will mandate that the insurance companies that in the RFP process will actually require that component where people can get coverage through the primary care that they've developed a relationship with. We also have a concern about the 60-day requirement, and I understand the Woodwork effect and people concerned about families dropping coverage, but I also thought about just recently I transferred jobs, and I'm in a 90-day waiting period for my new insurance to kick in, and so I'm in COBRA. And COBRA, it can be incredibly expensive for people to pick up, and luckily I'm able to do that, but I thought of my mother when as a low-income family, and she would not have been able to do this for us, and that when people lose their health coverage without no fault of their own from losing coverage through an employer or another circumstance, we should have a system in place that covers them immediately so they don't have to wait 60 days. We would also like, and I'm talking really fast because I acknowledge the fact that you guys have been here for a long time, so I apologize about that. But I'd also like to go on the record that we believe that this is a first step in healthcare reform and that there is more to do, and we hope that you will take that on this session. We need comprehensive healthcare reform in Oregon, and we need restoration of the people who lost services during the cuts to the Oregon Health Plan. Those 80,000-plus people who lost coverage in the last five, six, 7 years, really had, we gave them a promise. We told them we would cover them in the state, and then we took that promise away. And by covering those low-income families, not just children, but the families, you ensure both a healthy family and you ensure that those children actually access coverage, because when families are covered, children more than likely will receive coverage at the same time. So I apologize for talking at about 90 miles an hour, but thank you for allowing me to testify before you today. This is an important issue.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me. My name is John Dewar, and I'm here representing Core-Mark to discuss our opposition to the tobacco tax increase, which would fund the governor's plan to provide health care for children. Core-Mark is a distributor of tobacco products to both large and small retailers. We employ 350 Oregonians and provide excellent wages and health care benefits. Our company has been serving retailers in Oregon since 1888, with offices and distribution centers in both Portland and Grants Pass. First, we'd like to note it's not the governor's plan that we are concerned with, but it is the funding mechanism of the plan that we are opposed to. Our state is home to over 1,000 convenience stores, many of which are owned by minorities and an immigrant population. Of all the products sold in these stores, cigarettes provide the most profit to these small stores and help them stay afloat. A tax increase on their most profitable product will cause many to close. This, in turn, will cause Core-Mark to have less retail outlets to distribute to and will cause company layoffs. Consumers in Oregon will skirt the new higher tax by purchasing cigarettes on Indian reservation lands, on the Internet, or on the black market. All three options are readily available at this point. All three options represent a large decrease of sales for both Core-Mark and our retailers, and all three options represent less revenue to the state of Oregon. Each time another cigarette excise tax is levied, the state of Oregon, retailers, and distributors face the problem of a diminishing return. Owning and operating a small store is a very labor-intensive endeavor. It's not an 8-to-5 job. Store owners put many, many hours in to ensure that they will have enough income to support their families. Small family stores run with a high overhead, low-profit environment, and whether we like it or not, cigarettes provide the livelihood for many Oregonians. We cannot place the burden of the governor's plan on one small segment of individuals, smokers and retailers. This proposal needs a funding mechanism that is widely based and one that does not damage legitimate Oregon businesses. We ask that legislatures think twice before funding this very important healthy care for children's plan with risky and unsafe cigarette taxes. Thank you.
Question. Thank you very much. Yes, Representative Greenway.
When Measure 30 went down, the cigarette tax decrease. Did that cause a significant increase in revenue for these small businesses?
Now say that again, please, sir.
When Measure 30 went down 2 years ago, the cigarette tax decreased because it had been sunset. I was wondering if that produced a significant increase in revenue for these fragile small businesses.
Not a significant increase. What produced probably more of an increase was when the state of Washington increased their tax up to their current levels at this point.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much for coming. Wayne Brady, Chris Garrard, Jason Williams, and Russ Walker. Whoever gets up there first.
I'm first.
In the first three, I should get a place to sit.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee. My name is Chris Garrard, and I'm President and CEO of Plant Pantries, Inc., and also a director of the Oregon Neighborhood Store Association. Plant operates 100 convenience stores in the Northwest, 85 of them being here in Oregon. Our Oregon operating area covers everywhere from the Columbia River, south to Salem, east to Sandy, and west to Forest Grove. We have 750 employees, and I'm proud to say that we provide affordable health insurance to all of our employees. In fact, the cost of that for the company is about $1.1 million a year, which is not an insignificant percentage of our company's profits. Because of our company's commitment to employees' health care needs, we would certainly agree that it's a noble and desirable goal to provide health care for kids and really everyone who can't afford it otherwise. But our serious concern is about the cost of this proposed program, and in particular, the source, amount, and reliability of the funding. Oregon is already collecting $317 million in cigarette taxes, and Senator Carter was correct to remind us the $78 million is coming from the Master Settlement Agreement, which is based on carton movement, $239 million direct excise taxes. This figure doesn't include corporate income taxes paid by retailers such as Plaid, Core-Mark, and I believe Core-Mark underestimated the number of small family-owned retail businesses in Oregon, because ANZA's count is more like 2,800. I think people are going to talk about how do cigarettes relate to cigarettes used by adults relate to child health care. I'd almost rather like to use the term widget, if that helps. If 20% of Oregon's widget users are asked to pay for this, that means that they're going to have to pay five times the amount of tax that we all would pay if it was supported by everybody in the state. Or if you don't like widgets, why don't we tax candy, soda pop, hamburgers, french fries, or lattes? There are arguable connections there, at least as strong as adult smokers versus child health care. Representative Richardson is not here, but I think he's asking the right questions about costs. I don't think we've nailed the cost down. Plaid Pantries is not against this, but we want to know what it's going to cost and the impact that it's going to have on our company. Are a lot of our people going to leave? And then it drives up the remaining people in the group to where it becomes unaffordable for the people that don't qualify for the program. There's a lot of questions that we have. We're scared to death about this, frankly. But I want to focus on the assumptions as the expected revenue. We are experts in smokers and how many they are and what they do. And as part of our business with our suppliers and the manufacturers, we have to analyze this. And I'm trying to get a picture of what the revenue projections are. And what I know is what I read in the newspaper. And I hear that it's 170 to 180 million per biennium. If you take today's carton movement, which is about 20 million cartons, multiply it by the new tax, it's double that number, which tells me the proponents of the bill have done some analysis and they have determined that about 4 million cartons are going to go away.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Pardon me? The estimates for the second, for the full biennium are higher than that you've mentioned.
They are.
And they are available, yeah.
Okay. That worries me more because what we haven't seen or haven't fully realized is that when Washington did raise its tax, our steady decline in unit taxed movement, because most of it went to untaxed sources, not only recovered Oregon's decline, but we picked up a lot of cigarette cartons. And in fact, our estimates are about 5 million cartons are from out-of-state, primarily Washington, consumers. Washington is contributing $80 to $100 million a year to Oregon's general fund. When we raise the tax like this, I think this is the part that's underestimated. That's going to go away overnight. And most of you don't know me. I'm not prone to sensationalism. That's a reality. And in the charts, when you look at it, I don't want to bog you down in all of our analysis, but I would urge you, particularly when this gets to the Revenue Committee, to look at the assumption on that, because it worries me to put together something with large costs where you're going to get really disappointed in the funding. The sources are just so easy. Right now, we know that there's 30 to 45 million uncollected taxes. Some estimates are as high as 100 million, but I'm not going to get sensational. But there's unquestionably 30 to 45 million. This extra $8 is going to force more Oregonians to decide whether or not they want to cheat a little bit and buy it off the internet. Carrying costs, delivery costs aren't that much, but it probably costs $5 to get a shipment of cigarettes. With a $10 tax, 50 cents a pack isn't that much. $1.50, you're going to have a lot more people on the web going to the Native American reservations. The interesting thing is Idaho is going to become the beneficiary that Oregon was of Washington. Now, it's a long way to Idaho from here in Portland. So a lot of that's not going to happen. But mail order from low-tax states. The question about raising the tax to $11, again, forget that it's cigarettes. It's just the price elasticity and the alternatives that the consumer has. What that will do is say, nobody's going to buy any cigarettes in Oregon. That's just a fact. I'm kind of getting off my script here, but... When you get around to looking at my graph, when you see that big jump, I wish I could say it was really good marketing by Plaid Pantry and other retailers. But the kind of gray line is where the trend was. And you can see before 05, 06, there was a very predictable trend. We make our annual projections on this. This is part of our business, and it's what we do. If you look at that and don't think that once we match Washington, it's not going to snap right back to where it was, and that's before you take into the account the incidence of the new part of the tax. Over the next year, as that sinks in, there's going to be a big bump after the floor tax. 5 million are going to go away like that, and we're going to lose another million cartons. See, I'm getting bogged down in the numbers. I'm saying that the revenue estimate is off by two. It's not going to be... $85 million. It's going to be half that. And I would hate for that to be a surprise. So I'm asking you, and again, we'll do it in the Revenue Committee, when it comes time to look at this, I wish you'd go to the industry people who understand price elasticity and where the customers are coming from and where they're going to go. One other quick point. This is an ironic thing. Looking at the retailers, if we, and I believe we're going to lose at least those 6 million cartons from the 20 million down to 14.1, that's going to destroy 260 million in legal sales activity by law-abiding retailers selling to law-abiding customers who are not trying to avoid the tax. That translates to 38 million in corporate profits, counting the Core-Marks and the Plaids of the world. This thing is going to destroy more corporate profit bottom line activity than it's going to raise in tax, which is the answer to the $11 tax question. You reach a point where when you knock a carton out or a widget, you lose the profit you made up to that point on the one that goes away. And these will go away.
Can you sum up?
Pardon me?
Can you sum up?
Thank you for indulging me. A fair solution would be to not single out a minority of the population to pay for this and not single out a minority of Oregon's small business to carry the full load. Biggest danger is it will create a large ongoing expense, and the source that you're counting on is not going to pay the bills. If we're determined to create this plan, it's only fair that all Oregonians, not just a small, relative, voiceless minority, be asked to fund it. Thank you very much.
You know, no program is free, and this wouldn't be free. And it would be interesting to know if the industry would ever consider a proposal like a payroll tax or something like that, which is worse.
Well, Madam Chair.
Or which is better.
Madam Chair, I certainly don't recommend raising taxes very often. But my point is, it would be less costly to business and the Oregon economy overall, bottom line, if you simply directly taxed us instead of hurting this part of the business that goes way beyond the amount of tax it's going to raise. So I don't know what you call that in economics or policy or whatever, but boy, it doesn't make sense to me. So in the context that you ask it, I'd rather have a direct tax on my business. There's people back here that are going to kick me when I leave here.
I just wanted something like that on the record.
I would put it on the record. I would rather have a direct tax on our business than have something that devastates this industry. A third of our business is cigarettes, and there are a lot of people that don't like cigarettes. But Plaid Pantry and all these other entrepreneurs are people selling a legal product. The state... it's a huge revenue stream for the state. We don't mind that. Our customers don't mind that. But you reach this point to where you can't squeeze it anymore.
Thank you.
We may not be there now.
Questions?
Chair.
Representative Gilson.
Thank you very much for your testimony. It's interesting to refer to the Revenue Committee. I'm serving on the Revenue Committee along with Representative Bruin, and yesterday we had an excellent presentation on the cigarette tax and the cigarette tax as it related to healthy kids, and we discussed the difficulty of not having some information that would be appropriate before the Health Committee in our considerations. I'm thinking that here the reverse might be true, and perhaps we could get tapes for those of us that are on the committee for the history of the tobacco tax that Mazden went through, and specifically he showed the intersecting lines, the exact impact on total revenues in the state that the Washington increase in tax had and the stability over time, including the assumptions that went into the projections that are being made.
Good suggestion. Okay. And just for those in the audience, we'll be finishing this panel and then we have to get out. So we are going to continue public testimony on Friday. And so if you would check with administrative staff, it'll be 3:00 on Friday, of who were on these lists that we didn't get to, so that we will start up with these same lists. And if you can't be
there. There is a possibility that we really do need to discuss it, whether we'll move to invited testimony on Friday or have public testimony. So it seems to me that decision hasn't been quite made. You probably want to check with the committee administrators and see if you can get to be invited testimony if we decide not to take public.
Okay, let's... it's my preference as chair, and we will discuss with the co-chair here, to have public testimony. We truly need public testimony, and if you can, we would like to have you back. Okay.
Chairs, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jason Williams, Taxpayer Association of Oregon, director. I think one of the primary concerns we need to ask is that at this point, 2 years from now, that when we look back, if this becomes in effect, that we realize that, hey, the cost didn't spiral out of control.
For the record, you are?
Jason Williams,
thank you.
And that the cost didn't go beyond what we expected, and that our revenue source didn't shrink as we unexpected, and that we didn't negatively change human behavior. And that's what I want to address today, because I think the cigarette tax is unstable. There, as I looked at the six-year period between 98 and 02, when there was no price changes, it averaged out a 5% decline every year. So this is a shrinking. Part of it is because we have less smokers. The number of smokers have been cut in half over the past 35 years. Also, we're trying to determine the revenue. People do respond to it, and I'm reminded that 40 states increased the cigarette tax, and if you look at what they did in their projections, that out of that 40, only 8 had the projections come out correctly. The rest were under what they expected. So we know from how other states operate, including Oregon, that we always come under, the funds come under projected, and that is something because by nature, the cigarette tax is unstable. It changes. The behavior is changing. We're like taxing a person on their way out the door. So, and especially with the rise of, as described earlier, with border sales, internet, mail, it all contributes to the instability. So if something is this important, we don't want to attach it on to something that is unstable. The other thing about changing people's behavior, and I really do worry about with people being able to afford it, but then either not doing it and taking up the state program or dropping the coverage to take up the state program. And if I could give an example, I remember when I lived in an apartment complex and word spread very quickly that there was this brand new apartment complex being built and it was for affordable housing. And they were out there, looking for people. And so what happened was my neighbor, he had two jobs. He had to have two jobs because he had a very bad drinking habit and gambling habit. So he quit one of his jobs, so we qualify, so he left. And another person in the apartment complex, she was a nurse. She said, hey, I'm just going to go from full-time to part-time. And so she left. And so all these people were leaving from our apartment to go to a government-subsidized housing unit. And so this idea that only 3%, I don't think that captures it when we're talking about the crowd-out factor, because the people that will misuse the system, they talk to each other. They're kind of in a community on their own. And hey, when you're in troubled times, you look for those things. And in this case, when I look back at that, I realize that, hey, my tax dollars went to pay for one person to become unproductive and not work, and my tax dollars went to go pay to help fund someone's, you know, bad habits. So, but there's a lot of reasons that make up why people do not have insurance, and one of the ones that hasn't been talked about yet is the people that are in transition. A large portion of the people that do not have insurance usually get it within a few months, and those people are not captured in here. And with a program like this, they will probably capture those people, and they probably will not let them go for a while. And they're not. And every time we add someone to a program, that either hey, they can afford it for themselves, they shouldn't be on there, they change their lifestyles to incorporate because of it, or they're in transition. Every time we do that, that means we're paying for that cost, and that's less money to pay for the people who really do need it. So I think there are two things that are really flawed with this plan, the plan to begin with, and also attaching it to the cigarette tax. And when the chair brought up, well, you know, nothing is free, it's got to cost something, well, I would figure that with the near 18% growth in the budget, you know, why can't we just reprioritize and use existing general fund revenues? And that becomes the biggest problem that I feel in the capital, as they do the budgeting. It's really hard to prioritize because suddenly everything appears as the number 10 most important list. But if this is truly as important as the proponents of it make, well then, do it with the most stable of all funds, the general fund, and not something that has such a history of being unstable. Thank you.
Comment.
Thank you. I'd like this question. Yeah. I just want to understand what you're saying. You're saying you would support the Healthy Kids Act if it was financed by general funds?
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, no, I'm saying that if that is your high priority, if this is a top priority, then there's existing funds to do it. And the problem that we see is that, you know, millions of dollars will go to art programs or, you know, millions of dollars gets taken away for urban renewal and you know, urban construction. And so suddenly those things are not prioritized with, you know, giving insurance for kids.
May I follow on that, Chair? I'll ask the question again. If we were to fund this by general funds, does that mean the taxpayer union would support it? We prioritize it into the existing general fund. Would you support the Healthy Kids insurance program?
Chair Greenlit, no. This system is flawed. There is a way to get those kids insured. This is not the way to do it.
Okay, so it's not about taxes. It's about you just won't support it.
No, not this program. No, it's flawed.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, Russ Walker, members of the committee. Russ Walker, I represent Freedom Works, Citizens for Sound Economy. We're a nonprofit policy think tank and advocacy group. We have approximately 30,000 members in the state of Oregon, and we're led by former Majority Leader Dick Armey and Steve Forbes. I hope not to repeat anything that's already been said, so I'm kind of going to jump around my notes, and I hope you'll forgive me and be patient with me as I do that. But that way I can keep my testimony shorter and get straight to the point. First of all, I do want to repeat a couple things. We do have a $2 billion increase in revenue in the state of Oregon that we have the ability to spend. You have the ability to spend as a legislature this biennium. We do not believe as an organization that it is necessary to raise any taxes to meet our policy needs for the state of Oregon in this biennium. So let me just state that first. And then let me state second that it is our opinion that these two items in this bill in 2201 should be separate items for discussion. The discussion over healthy kids should be separated from the funding mechanism. We as an organization are opposed to both. Let me also just state that. We do believe that Healthy Kids is fundamentally flawed. We believe it is a middle-class subsidy, and it is a middle-class entitlement that the state of Oregon should not engage in. Also, we believe that the funding mechanism is fundamentally flawed as well. Let me address the funding mechanism just very quickly, the regressivity of it, and then I'll address some of our concerns about Healthy Kids.
amongst all the other reasons to avoid using cigarette taxes to fund something, especially something as important, if you do deem this as an important program, something as important as health care for children, the cigarette tax and the tobacco taxes are probably one of the worst funding mechanisms you can use. It has a point of diminishing returns. It is also a regressive tax. We are asking smokers and tobacco users in the state of Oregon who have an addiction, frankly, to fund single-handedly a program for the rest of the state of Oregon. We're asking smokers who may make $15,000 a year or $35,000 a year or $50,000 a year to subsidize the health care for children and families that make up to $74,000 a year. As an organization, we think that is immoral. We think it is unfair. We think that if the state of Oregon deems this as a priority, and if this legislative body decides to support this piece of policy, the children's plan, then what they should do is they should defer those costs to every taxpayer in the state of Oregon and not target one small segment of the state of Oregon that happens to have a habit that is very unpopular. If that is the case, we should also maybe figure out a way to tax obesity, figure out a way to tax sugared foods, figure out a way to tax other types of items that have similar health risks and carry a similar burden in health costs to our health system. I don't think we're going to have that discussion, frankly. I don't want to have that discussion. I think that's equally as wrong. But it points out the flaw with wanting to tax one small segment minority in order to fund something that's for everyone in the state of Oregon. Let me go ahead and just throw out a couple figures. According to U.S. Census, the median household income in the state of Oregon is $43,000 a family, roughly. If you make $15,000 a year, you will carry, as a smoker, if you smoke one pack a day, the burden to you with this tax will be 7.1% of your total income. Currently, if you smoke one pack of cigarettes a day, your taxes, federal and state taxes, are roughly $756 a year. With this tax, Oregon taxpayers, smokers, and tobacco users will pay over $1,000 a year, $1,064 a year in taxes. If you make $75,000 a year, your tax burden, if you are a one-pack-a-day user, will be 1.4% of your total income. You see the problem with regressivity. Those lower-income taxpayers in the state of Oregon will carry a disproportionate amount of the burden for paying for this program. I do not believe that there's anyone on this committee who thinks, I would be shocked if any of you think it's okay to tax the poorest Oregonians to fund a program that's going to impact everybody in the state of Oregon and only tax them because of a behavioral issue they have that is also tied to an addiction. So let me just finish with a couple problems we have with the program, because I think it's fair to say that. Freedom Works, Citizens for Sound Economies, opposes this program because we think it'll have a couple of effects. Number one, it will disincentivize people from providing for their own insurance, especially middle-class Oregonians. When you have a medium household income of $43,000 a year, this doesn't just impact the middle class, it impacts the upper middle class at $74,000 a year. It also disincentivizes employers from providing health care to the dependents of their workers. The impact of that is, as workers move from private health care systems into this program, will be you will reduce the number of participants in the private universe systems, the number of participants in that universe, therefore increasing the cost for those folks left in the universe in those private plans, because there will be less people in those private plans to defer those costs. That's the impact of the market. If you want to address health care, we think that the state of Oregon, and quite frankly, I think there's some things in this program that could be transferred over to the Oregon Health Plan that would help increase efficiencies and reduce costs to the Oregon Health Plan. And we think that's what we should be talking about. How do we make the Oregon Health Plan more effective, rather than how do we create a brand new program that is going to create a subsidy and entitlement for the middle class of the state of Oregon? Second, and finally, I think, let me just outline a number of things that we would suggest that this body take up this session that unfortunately are outside of the discussion, and we think it's unfortunate. The market-based approaches, tax credits to businesses, tax credits to individuals for buying their own insurance products. How about tax cuts to the middle class so they have more money in their own pocket to buy their own health care products? How about tax exempt?
We need you to sum up.
I will. Thank you. Sorry, Madam Chair. How about medical savings accounts? How about making all medical costs tax exempt? There are a number of different approaches we can take. A medical liability reform is something we're not going to discuss this session, and does impact the cost of health care. Let me just say that there's a lot of things we can look at. The Oregon Health Plan is underutilized. I think this system will be underutilized. Unfortunately, I think it sets up an entitlement, and it's not a well thought out program from our perspective. And the funding cost is even worse. The funding mechanism is far worse than the actual system itself. And that's it. Thank you,
Madam Chair.
Thank you very much.
Yes, Skip. Yeah, we have to. Unfortunately, we have to get out of here because another committee is coming in. So can we have the last one, unless you can come on Friday?
I'll just be very short because, Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'll be very short because a lot of the things I was going to say have already been covered. One thing about
the... Introduce yourself.
Wayne Brady. I'm testifying as a private citizen. I work part-time for Senator Gary George, but I'm not on his time today. It was mentioned that the cigarette tax is regressive. It's regressive. It's double regressive in a way because smokers are overrepresented in the low-income classes. So they're getting hit. It not only as a percentage of their income, but they're a major contributor to this tax. And I think that's wrong. Also, as was mentioned, trying to subsidize middle class and upper middle class people isn't the right way we should be going. We should be going toward less government involvement in Medicare and not more. I'm also concerned about the projections of cost. Having seen what happened with the projections for the Oregon Health Plan in the past, we should... be careful what we're getting ourselves into. So those are the main points. I really think that with the income you have now, there's really not a reason for more taxes. And it seems to be a frenzy in this building of building, you know, more and more taxes on just about anything you can think of, insurance and water and everything. And so I think the Oregon taxpayers are paying plenty.
Thank you very much. And just quick, Representative Gelser and Representative Cannon, before they really kick us out.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to make a comment. It's been stated by several people today that there really is no connection between cigarette use and children's health care. And I just, for the record, would like to dispute that. Cigarette use, unlike lattes or bagels or cookies, is one of the leading causes of low birth weight in babies, leads to childhood asthma and other kinds of childhood disorders. And cigarette smoking, unlike lattes and candy bars, also has the impact of not just impacting the user, but all of the people that are around them. And I think that that's why historically tobacco taxes have been used partially to fund the detrimental impacts of health care, not just to the users, but those around them, including their children.
And I'll withhold my question, given that I think I'm on the committee that's meeting here in the next couple of minutes.
Thank you very much for coming, and I apologize to the rest who have signed up and couldn't testify. We will be meeting at 3 o'clock. Please check with administrative staff regarding. So go ahead.
I close. Okay. Right. Thanks for being here. House committee.